Rick Smith Show starts now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with our friend and attorney Irwin Aronson about what's going on here in the city of Harrisburg with this. Either it's bankruptcy or they're going to try and fight to block it. Is it legal? Is it illegal? We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the governor's education scheme. How we're going to open the door to privatization and the destruction of public education. And also, if we've got time, a little bit of the election rigging that the governor and the Republicans are attempting to overreach with. So should be good talking about that. Also, Mike Crossey, president of the PSEA, is going to be talking about the governor's education scheme. And really from a perspective of, what should we be doing? Look, this privatization scam, we know what this is. This is a ripoff of the taxpayers. This is a ripoff of every education dollar that goes to these organizations that are now starting up these schools for what? For profit. So they can put a little money in their pocket. They can pay their administrators big bucks. Look, there are a lot of problems. Why not fix the system we have? If there are some schools that are struggling, why not go and fix those? Why not deal with the problems there instead of saying, you know what, we're just going to chuck the whole system and let it and just destroy it. And you know what, all those kids that don't get the golden ticket, all those kids who don't get accepted, all of those, well, they're just going to fall behind. Wouldn't that be a smart idea? Maybe figure out how to fix some of the problems that we have? Just an idea. Also in the third hour, David Bacon, photojournalist and author, going to be talking about the trade agreements and really about, you know, how they compare to NAFTA and what NAFTA has done to the country. I mean, you know, you look today and I'm still fuming over the fact that those trade agreements just, they breezed right through. There was no real opposition to any of the trade agreements with Colombia, South Korea, or Panama. And why is that? Well, there's a lot of truth in the fact that there's really one party when it comes to the trade, man. There's one party when it comes to Wall Street. There's one party when it comes to the wealth class. And that's why people are still in the streets. That's where people, I think more people are going to take to the streets. And party leaders, you better wake up. You better pay attention to what's being said. And I know the mainstream corporate-controlled media is doing everything they can do to marginalize and minimize. But at the end of the day, this thing is growing. And I guess Friday night after the show here, we'll begin the Occupy Harrisburg over on the Capitol steps. We are going to head over after the show and participate in that for a little bit. I hope to see you there as well. So today I'm driving around. I'm coming into work, and I hear, and I don't listen to talk radio too much because, you know, it's just the righties just drive me nuts. But I've been told that I need to hear the other side. And the reality is the other side's full of it. It's a whole, you know, dance. They've got their talking points and it's a whole play. But I kept hearing this person talking about teachers. And they kept calling them crummy teachers. These crummy teachers. Everyone knows who these crummy teachers are. And I couldn't help but sit there and go, you know what? I've met a good number. I've met all of my kids' teachers, and I've met a good number of teachers across the state. And you know what? I wonder how they feel about being characterized broadly as crummy teachers. I wonder what kind of morale boost that is. I wonder what kind of morale boost it is when little Johnny or Jane walks into the classroom and says, Mrs. So-and-so, Daddy says you're a crummy teacher. You know, I just kind of wonder about that. And what's going on here is this is the right-wing mob mentality, this piling on, because they really want to destroy public education. They really want to destroy it because they don't want average everyday people rising up. They want their little worker class that they can control and divide, which is why you don't see critical thinking skills taught that much. We teach regurgitation, the slap method. Sit, listen, attention, and participate. You know, that's it. Not critically think, not solve problems. So I kind of listen to this, and there's for like 40 minutes I'm driving, and I hear all of this bashing of public education, how there are people who are prisoners in these systems, and how you know these evil teachers unions and these evil teachers who have tenure, how they're destroying the nation, how they're taking us down the wrong path. And I'm thinking back to my education, and as I remember, every teacher that I think I had from eighth grade on all had tenure. Now, I can't remember a crummy teacher. I remember teachers who, to me, were less than inspiring. But here's the thing. The kid next to me probably was inspired by that teacher. I mean, because there's a lot of differences. I mean, there are some teachers who people didn't like when I was in school who I absolutely thought were the greatest things on earth, because they caught my attention. And a teacher isn't the same thing to every person. I mean, what we're doing to education is we're industrializing it. We're turning it into factory work. Here are all these children, and these are little empty vessels, and we're going to pour information into their empty heads, and you're going to do this, and it's like factory work. It has to be done on time, and it has to be done within this time frame, and you have to do this at this time, and everything is very militarized, industrialized. Everything's on a clock. Everything has to be done with set deadlines and goals. And you know what? Kids don't learn that way. I mean, they need structure, but everybody learns at a little bit different pace, which is why a teacher, someone who is trained, someone who is qualified, someone who has done this year after year after year, understands that process and brings each kid along in a little different way. This idea that there's this crummy teacher out there who's just destroying the education system, it's kind of scary to me. But again, the right is good at tearing things down. Very few of them are carpenters. Most of them are demolition experts. They know how to tear something down, don't really understand how to build something. Not something that benefits all of us. Something that benefits themselves. Oh, they're very good at that. Something I can put in my pocket. Oh, very, very good. Yes, yes. But something that benefits the community, not so much. And I look at the governor's plan, and if you look at the plan, there is no emphasis on fixing the few problems that may be out there, the few schools that may be struggling, the few areas that may have a little bit of problem. There's nothing. This latest silver bullet is not going to help those schools that are struggling right now. It's not. I'm sorry. Maybe one or two kids from those schools, maybe. But it's not the silver bullet that we're being sold. So the four main components of Corbett's plan. Pretty simply, they want to expand the educational improvement tax credit. And I'm saying, well, you know, instead of offering these golden ticket lottery winnings, why not take that $75 million expansion, put it into the schools that are struggling, and fix the problems that are deeper than just what's in the classroom? Fix the problems that are deeper into the community. There's an idea. You want to get your corporate friends to maybe save a couple of bucks? Why don't you get them to create jobs in those areas? Because I'm of the mindset the schools that are struggling the greatest are the ones in the highest poverty areas. But we don't want to talk about that. We just want to talk about those crummy teachers who, you know, they're just greedy. And what's bothersome to me, we're overhauling this charter school law. We're basically going to open a bed. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to take taxpayer money. Go ahead. Start your little charter school. And we've seen time and time again with honest studies not the ones done by the voucher people, but honest university studies that really the whole charter thing hasn't lived up to the promises. It hasn't lived up to the mind-blowing change we've been promised. It's not. Other part of this that Corbett wants to push in there is we're going to evaluate teachers on the children's performance. Not just their performance. Not just what we observe in the classroom. Just not that they present. Not that they get up there and they actually present the information and they do the job. No, no. The kids have to hear it. So if their stomachs are empty or if they didn't go to sleep till midnight the night before and they're half asleep in the class, the teacher will be penalized because of that. And I'm telling you what's going to happen. In those districts, you will find that no teacher wants to go there. But you hear the righties, you hear the tinky tank heads, you hear all these people say, well, that's a crummy teacher who can't get through to that kid who hasn't gotten a good night's sleep and hasn't had anything to eat. Yeah, that's a crummy teacher. And the other part of this, the fourth part, is, taxpayers are going to foot the bill to set up these private schools. And I ask the question again, why can't we invest that money into the schools we've already got? So Corbett, who I'm calling the education governor, I think Corbett is now the education governor. He has an education plan. Remember last budget year, he chose to deal with our revenue problems because we had a revenue shortfall last year. He chose to deal with that by gutting and cutting school funding. So instead of taxing the drillers, instead of closing that Delaware loophole, instead of going after other sources of revenue, he chose to cut education funding he wanted $1 billion. The Republicans in the House and Senate said, well, let's look like the good guys and we'll scale that back to $860 million. So you've got this $860 million in state funding cuts, which means larger classroom sizes, which means 14,000 educators to the curb in the state of Pennsylvania. It means a whole lot of very negative things. So you got this $860 million cut, all the negatives that come with it, in one hand. On the other hand, you've got very happy drillers. You've got very happy P.O. Box corporations in Delaware who are able to launder their profits through their magical P.O. Box. Because those P.O. Boxes in Delaware, they're magic. And they should write a fairy tale about these magic boxes that when you open the little door, all the profits from Pennsylvania are scrubbed free of taxes because there's this wonderful little box, this porthole through profitability. And yet we're the dumb ones in this. We're the ones who elected this guy who told you he wasn't going to tax the drillers, told you he wasn't going to close the Delaware loophole, told you he was not going to raise any more revenue into the state. He was going to cut your kids' education. He was going to cut programs for the needy. He told you that, and you voted for him anyway. So this nonsense of, well, we've got, I have voters' remorse. If you've got voters' remorse over Tom Corbett, you were not paying attention. It's that simple. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin's worker uprising goes on the offense as the recall against Governor Scott Walker kicks off. Jesse Russell reports.
A kickoff date for the recall effort against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has officially been set. The main group coordinating the effort is United Wisconsin, and they announced on Tuesday that November 15th will be the official start date of collecting signatures. Supporters of the governor have said any recall attempt will be disruptive to the state and create chaos. Ryan Lawler from United Wisconsin disagreed, stating that the chaos started with Walker's budget repair bill.
The introduction of the budget repair bill and the damage that that repair bill and the policies that Governor Walker has proposed ran through the legislation, wreaking far more havoc on what is just a part of the political landscape, the recall process.
Contrary to claims that the recall effort is limited to the state's liberal stronghold of Madison, United Wisconsin said they're working with grassroots recall groups throughout the state.
There's a number of different grassroots groups representing basically the entire geography of Wisconsin.
United Wisconsin doesn't see the desire to recall the governor waning in the state, even 7 months since the largest protest rally. United Wisconsin's Kevin Straka.
There are other formidable drivers such as health care, education, voter ID, tuition increases, etc.
The Occupy protest movement continues to grow as police in Washington, D.C. and Boston arrest some Occupy protesters. About 120 people were arrested in Boston for allegedly refusing an order to leave. Occupy Boston spokesperson Philip Anderson told the Boston Globe,
200 police in riot gear moved in. It got kind of brutal. Veterans, union workers, students were thrown to the ground, put in headlocks, dragged across the ground. Some people injured themselves. 100 plus people got arrested. That included medics, that included legal observers, that included ranking members of the National Lawyers Guild.
Occupy Wall Street expressed its solidarity with their Boston brothers and sisters and commended them for asserting the right of the people to peacefully assemble. In Washington, D.C., at least 6 Occupy D.C. protesters were arrested as they tried to unfurl banners in the Hart office building to urge the Senate to pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. SEIU and Interfaith Worker Justice held a prayer vigil at the Senate Tuesday as it appeared Democrats could not muster the 60 votes they need to pass the Jobs Act. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. If you miss any portion of the program, the website, that's a good place to get the podcast. Also, if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app, and you can take the program with you on the go. So Harrisburg is in the national news, and not really in a good way. The 4-3 vote yesterday to file bankruptcy. They sent their lawyer that they had hired, Mr. Schwartz, over to file the paperwork. There's, I guess, somebody going to file something to stop it. The state's saying, hey, it's illegal. So many questions. A bigger question for me, what happens to the workers? What happens to the taxpayers? Here to help us work through some of that, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Irwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, good to be here, Rick.
What an absolute mess.
Yeah, you could say that. I say this is like a law school exam. Here are 42 impossible situations. Describe all the rights, duties, and obligations of everybody involved.
There you go. and at $300 an hour, because Attorney Schwartz is taking a cut from his normal $525 an hour gig.
I so far in this conversation, I've learned at least one thing I have failed to do properly professionally.
Well, you didn't get the big gig with the city. So I guess the first question I've got, they went and they filed Chapter 9. Is it legal?
Well, Pennsylvania is one of 19 states in which municipal bankruptcies are permitted. Where we start analytically is on two parallel tracks. Track number one is that the bankruptcy code and the Chapter 9 to which we're referring is part of the United States, the federal bankruptcy code. Many of our listeners probably have heard of Chapter 7, Chapter 11, and Chapter 13
right.
of the bankruptcy code. Chapter 7 is a straight bankruptcy. Your debts are wiped out. Chapter 11 is a business reorganization, and Chapter 13 is a personal reorganization. So store that for a second, and then we deal with what is an entity like the city of Harrisburg. In Pennsylvania, all of the political subdivisions, cities, boroughs, townships, counties, school districts, municipal authorities, housing authorities, water authorities, transportation authorities, school officials, sewer authorities, all of these are known as political subdivisions, and they are creatures of and created by the state. None of these entities have an independent existence. The existence exists because the state has established a legislative and a constitutional framework under which these kinds of public bodies are permitted to be created. And they are referred to in general as political subdivisions of the state of, in this case, Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Right.
And that description is significant because they are subdivisions of Pennsylvania. They are not independent of Pennsylvania state government. So part of that broad framework that I just described that exists in Pennsylvania and 18 other states permits political subdivisions, in this case a municipality like Harrisburg, to avail themselves of the protection provided by the United States Bankruptcy Code in general, in Chapter 9 in particular, because Chapter 9 is the portion of the bankruptcy code that addresses municipal or government agency kinds of bankruptcies for other than the federal government and state government itself.
Right. So as I'm getting this, the opportunity for different entities to be defined in this this whole process, you know, now I look at this and there's part of me that goes, I get that on a number of levels, but is it legal? I mean, I've seen a number of reports that, you know, it's not legal for the city of Harrisburg, which I guess is a class three city according to some of the reports that I've seen in this. And this status, this third class city status, this class three status somehow doesn't allow us to allow them to file bankruptcy. So this class three status is something fairly important. So I'm kind of curious, and you look at this and, you know, how this all works itself out, how it all, comes down the line, this class three city status, how does this work into the whole system there?
Well, I'm sorry, through the gods who, monitor our conversations, kept me from hearing some of what you were just saying, so I'm not exactly sure the question you're asking of me.
Well, what I've seen that them say that the reason that Harrisburg can't file bankruptcy is because it's considered something as a third-class city?
Well, there are, in the stratification that I was describing of political subdivisions, there are cities of the first class. Pennsylvania has exactly one of those, Philadelphia. Cities of the second class, we have exactly one of those, Pittsburgh. And then there are others, second class A, third class, and then classifications or stratifications of boroughs and townships as well. Harrisburg is a city of the third class with a home rule charter. A home rule charter means that we have a strong mayor system in Harrisburg. There is a thought on the part of some observers that the permissibility conferred by Pennsylvania law on municipalities to avail themselves of the protection of the federal bankruptcy code, of the United States bankruptcy code, is not absolute, that there are some limitations, and one of those limitations happens to be whether the entity attempting to file bankruptcy is a city of the third class versus a city of the first or second class or second class A. So that's an argument that somebody's going to doubtlessly put forward. There will be a host of arguments. In the end, what's really significant for us here that we should be concerned about is that unlike most businesses that produce and or sell goods, commodities, or certain kinds of services. A municipality like the city of Harrisburg has really only one broad-based continuous expense, and that is the employees that keep our streets clean, the employees that keep our water systems going, the employees that protect us in days of danger like we had a few weeks ago when the city was overwhelmed with flooding, and our first responders, firefighters, police officers, ambulance and other safety drivers and attendants and crews and paramedics. These are all municipal employees whose obligation to work never wavers, whose commitment to this community was virtuously extolled only a few weeks ago when they were feted over all the wonderful things they had done to protect us in this time of extreme need, that particular emergency, and it would that be the only emergency. And now they're going to be asked to continue to work without knowing whether or not they're going to get paid, without knowing whether or not their benefits are going to be set aside, without knowing whether or not their pension rights that they have paid for either directly out of their pockets in most cases, or indirectly by giving up wages in return for the city of Harrisburg agreeing to make appropriate contributions. That's all at risk, and then we are all also at risk because that's at risk. The Wall Street bankers and bond players who are so heavily leaning on Harrisburg have yet to miss a payday on all of this. They're still getting paid. They are still, as your intro indicates, living behind the gated communities of their chambers of commerce. But our municipal workers, our dedicated first responders, our trash collectors, our parking meter readers, our police officers, our firefighters, our dedicated city hall workers who process tax and related claims, who process all manner of financial transactions, who issue building permits so that others can get to work on construction in the city, and a host of others are all very immediately at risk because Chapter 9, among other things, may very well permit a set-aside, if you will, of even collectively bargained obligations of the municipality.
And here you go again. And what bothers me about these agreements, and I've known some folks who have in the private sector who have gone through these kind of bankruptcies where, you know, their contracts were set aside, their pensions were written off, their health care was taken away, their wages were slashed. That's a worry for the workers. But what bothers me even more is that these people on Wall Street, they seem to always be protected. And it's the people who are at the bottom, the people who are at the margin, who are the ones who struggle the most and end up getting screwed the most.
Well, we live in a country that has spent the last quarter of a century socializing business losses and privatizing profits and gains. And here we are once again. We are fundamentally with this bankruptcy, and I understand the frustration of the members of City Council on both sides of the issue, and I understand the frustration of the mayor. And I even understand to some degree the frustration of members of the General Assembly who felt compelled to act. And I understand the notion of people who invested in the bonds being uneasy. But in the end, a city like Harrisburg or any other city is made up of two things. One is the people who live there. And the other is the people who serve them and who serve all of the visitors. We need to remember that there are not dozens, but literally hundreds of bedroom communities all around Harrisburg, covering several counties, where people come to Harrisburg to live, to work every day, and then jump in their cars or on public transportation and go to their little bedroom communities at night and contribute not to this city. But the city contributes to them every day by making sure that our streets are safe, by making sure that municipal services are available to them. There's a water, there's fresh potable water flowing through those pipes to them every day, even though that contribution is not being made. There's a firefighter standing at the ready 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And in the event of a hazard, a fire, or other things that firefighters deal with, they're there at the city's expense, at the city taxpayers' expense. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren, who's running for the United States Senate up in Massachusetts, has said it best in this country and certainly in this community. There isn't anybody who's making money and getting wealthy on their own. There's a foundation that the rest of us pay for. It's national defense. It's police protection. It's water and sewer systems. It's highways, roads, and streets. It's plows on the ground and trash being picked up, all of which create a foundation for those bondholders, in the case of the city of Harrisburg, to be comfortable. And now, with a bankruptcy, we are saying to all those people who provide that foundation, we expect you to come to work every day. We expect you to do your job. And you can't count on us to pay you.
That's an absolute shame. Let me ask you this. You know, and a couple of people I talked to today said, well, you know, they think that the bankruptcy filing was kind of the you know, the stick. You know, the old stick and carrot thing to get the bondholders to come to the table and you know, talk about something more equitable. What are your thoughts on this? Or is this really the path that the council wants to pursue?
Well, I think it's clearly the path that a majority of the members of the council have chosen to pursue. And in all honesty, I know Attorney Schwartz, and I've known him for many years. I haven't talked to him about this situation in the least. But he is not an insignificant player. This is a very significant, well-trained, well-versed, articulate, highly competent, very ethical lawyer, for whom I have a great deal of professional respect. I don't view this as a joke, and I don't view this as posturing, any more than I viewed the legislation that was put forth in the General Assembly a couple of weeks ago posturing, any more than I think that Mayor Thompson's Act 47 plan was posturing. But someplace along the line, we all have to do two things. One is we have to recognize that whether Democrats or Republicans, whether people we supported or people we opposed, this is a group of elected officials who we need to succeed. Because their success is our success, and their failure is our failure.
And that's just not here on the local level. That's all across the spectrum.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we need a whole lot of grown-up work instead of a little bit of childish play. This is a difficult and truly mind-boggling problem. And Harrisburg, of course, has a series of real and meaningful impediments. As long as Pennsylvania as a state chooses to finance much of the municipal activities and educational activities of its communities by way of a real property tax, Harrisburg is going to be at a continuous disadvantage because so much of the real estate value that exists in the city of Harrisburg is state buildings or religious organization buildings that are associated with this being the state capital,
right,
that are not taxable. So all of that capital complex that exists in the city, and yes, it's nice. It brings in a lot of people who work there during the day, and I you know, I'm proud and honored that I get to represent them. But the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania pays exactly $400,000 a year in payments in lieu of taxes to the city of Harrisburg. That doesn't exactly pay for providing police and fire protection and municipal services to the entire Capitol complex spread over literally dozens and dozens of prime real estate acreage in the city.
And that, to me, that should be something that should be looked at.
Very clearly, It needs to be dealt with, and how it gets dealt with in the context of a governor who has announced no taxes, who indeed has cut $200 million in business taxes, who has slashed nearly $1 billion in education funding, and places like Harrisburg suffer proportionally a great deal more in its educational system than other communities. These are not little problems, and these are not problems that are solved by partisan bickering. These are problems that are resolved by people who sit down with an honest and committed approach to reasoning together, recognizing that compromise isn't necessarily the most desirable thing, but it's the thing that people have to do. And I would be the last guy in line that suggests that we need to cheat the bondholders. But this doesn't have to be a zero-sum game where in order to not have the bondholders lose a penny, that our dedicated municipal workers who put their lives on the line for us every day have to work in insecurity about their jobs, work in insecurity about whether they're going to get paid for the wages that they have earned, work in insecurity worrying about what happens when one of their children becomes ill and they go to the hospital and discover that the health insurance premium wasn't paid, work in the insecurity of learning 25 years into a career that that pension that they had been building up as a alternative, as an alternative, if you will, to getting paid the wages to which they were really entitled, which they were really earning, is now at risk itself. Okay, and that's outrageous. But what's even more outrageous is their absolute basic day-to-day working conditions, their wages, their hours, their other terms and conditions of employment are immediately at risk in this bankruptcy proceeding. And a bankruptcy trustee has the potential capacity to come in and just abrogate those agreements.
And wipe all that stuff out. And all that stuff could be just taken from, I know people who've had their pensions swiped out from under them.
Yep.
And they end up on the back of the PBGC. And we, the taxpayers, still paying for it.
There's no PBGC even to cover municipal pensions. That's the point.
Correct. This is something we're going to be following closely for the next, until it's over. And we hope that you'll keep us abreast of the legal issues associated with it.
I will be honored to have the opportunity, and as long as you keep having me, I'll keep talking about things that I know a little bit about and making a lot of trouble.
Irwin, appreciate the time, brother.
Thank you. Take good care, my friend.
Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Gather round, children, and I'll tell you another fairy tale. But I must warn you, this one is really, really scary. So hold on to each other. It's about Rick Perry, the swaggering Texas governor who wants very, very much to be the Republican nominee for president. So, to get Republican primary voters to like him, he has been riding all across the country on a big horse he calls Money, claiming that he will save people everywhere by shooting down the horror of Romney Care. What's that, you ask? It's the Massachusetts Health Insurance Plan, developed by Ramblin' Rick's presidential rival, Mitt Romney. Why is it dangerous? Because, explains Perry, it is, quote, the model for socialized medicine. Big bad government should not be involved in health care, he shouts at Republican rallies, declaring that the sainted free market is the best provider of insurance. That's how we do it in Texas, he brags, and here comes the scary part. I'll bring the Texas model to all of America. Oh boy, that would not be nice or healthy. Under Pericare, more than 6 million Texans, including 1.3 million children, are left with no health coverage at all, the highest rate of uninsured residents in the country. Also, the price that people must pay for insurance has nearly doubled under Perry's reign. And he has slashed state spending and curbed eligibility for programs to help hard-hit families get health services. including cutting 200,000 Texas children out of a program to assure that low-income youngsters get health care. So, children, beware of yee-hawing Texas politicos spreading tales of free market miracles. Texans themselves find nothing miraculous about Pericare, referring to it as the yo-yo plan. You're on your own. This is Jim Hightower saying, luckily, though, people can write their own happy ending to this scary fairy tale. Just don't vote for it.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you've missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program with you anywhere you go. You may remember yesterday I talked a little bit about the conservative fundraiser and K Street lobbyist Nathan Wurzel and his big tweet. And you kind of got to consider the source. His plan, evidently, was, you know, to K Street of protesters, was to hit with his car. You know, let's hit him in the car, leave the rest in the street. He thought, you know, if you run a couple over, that'll be good. Then the rest will, you know, take off. So that, I guess, has taken some other conservatives to, you know, throw in with their ideas. And you look at this Kentucky city commissioner who said that he felt like going Taliban on the occupiers. We're going to go Taliban. He's a commissioner from the Covington, Kentucky city. Steve Frank is his name, a Republican. And, you know, he said, yeah, turn off the lights on the occupiers. I feel like going Taliban on them. So he was asked to explain. What do you mean? So, city commissioner Frank said, well, the Taliban, as they see it, is resisting occupation. And I'm resisting the occupiers and very proud to be a one percenter. He said, I figure that the irony would be lost on most of them dummies in the occupation nation who oppose the war in Afghanistan because they see us as occupiers. And he says, I happen to be against the war, too, but for highly different reasons. And you know, here's the thing. I seriously, seriously doubt that Mr. Frank is really a one percenter. And I've got to check into this a little bit more. Because, you know, here's the thing. If you're one of the 1%, you are not the city commissioner of Covington, Kentucky. Sorry, that's just not happening. Not at all. But you're seeing these protests are springing up. I've seen numbers at least 72. I've seen 150. A lot of it. And what's going on is people are saying, you know what? We're tired. You know, the income inequality, the rising cost of living, the food costs, the gas costs, all this stuff, and the fact that nobody on Wall Street has been held accountable. So all I've been hearing today from the haters is that the Occupy movement is violent. They're violent. They're spending I was listening to the one program, and they just kept playing clip after clip after clip of a handful of dumb people saying dumb things. And, you know, the people who were talking, I kind of understand. They're frustrated. And that frustration has spilled over into this need for immediate gratification, this need for immediate action. So if the occupiers turn violent, you know, if we can prove that they're violent, they can do away with the movement. And I'm saying right now, if the occupiers do indeed turn violent, which I doubt that's going to happen, but if they do, it's going to be a loss. And I think the vast majority of the people who are on these these picket on these protests get that. And they're very cognizant of what's going on. Now, look, you're going to get a handful. You're going to get a handful of nitwits who are going to do dumb things. And the other question is, how many of those nitwits saying and doing dumb things are Koch brother plants? How many of those people are there solely to troll the whole thing? I mean, we've seen a number of cases already where the billionaire class has sent in their little troublemakers and tried to make a story out of something that they've created. And that's what worries me. It does, because if this thing can spark, because all it does is it takes a couple of idiots. If it sparks, we may have problems. Because I'm sure that the police would be very happy to come in and break this thing up. So that's what I would say. Be very cognizant of who the people around you are, especially now at some point. These folks have been around each other for a while. They kind of know who the newcomers are. We went to one of the meetings here in Harrisburg, and a friend of ours, Mike Fedor, was videotaped in the meeting. Not saying anything overly controversial, said, look, you know, you got to get out in the streets, and if that means you get arrested, it happens. And you get back out there. And boy, that's made the right-wing rounds. And good for Mike. Well, I like Mike.
Well, you realize you did have a right-wing plan at that first meeting, Rick.
What do you think I just said?
Well, and you know who it was.
Well, I mean, it was probably either people from Freedom Works or people from the Tinky Tank or people from any of the Koch brother front groups.
It was Katie Abrams, who happens to be state president of the Americans for Prosperity.
Yeah, and is there any surprise? I was talking to, when we were down in Philadelphia, I was talking to a kid who's going, the police are videotaping us. And you go, really? You think so? You know, the cop with the camera, you didn't see him, and you don't see probably the helicopters above us. They're videotaping everything. There's probably someone in it from Glenn Beck's organization. There's probably someone in from every right-wing think tank in here trying to get you to say something dumb, trying to get you to flip off.
She was actually interviewed by Sean, our friend over at Fox News, Sean Hannity. She's the girl that became famous at the famous Lebanon, Pennsylvania healthcare meeting. And she went from there. And now she's a big to-do in the right-wing organization. And I heard her on, she's proud of it. Now she's going on radio. She was down in my neighborhood. She was being interviewed. She discussed the whole thing. She's proud of it.
And good for her. Anyway, but at the end of this, what it comes down to, just chill out. That's the end of it. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
My name is Toya. I'm a sales rep, and I work for Capital Blue Cross.
If you're choosing Medicare coverage, Toya will meet you anywhere to help you decide.
I met him at food courts, diners, the parks, on a bench. And today, we're meeting at airport.
Mike was a Navy service person, an engineer, and a pilot.
I'm a Senior Blue PPO member.
He is technically retired.
I'm a gray-haired teenager.
Mike appreciates the visit.
It's more personal, and you can talk easier. You can show emotion, which you can over the telephone, and it's more caring.
Toya would agree.
I love my customers. I really, really do. My main objective is to show them that I care. When you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 1-888-340-3978, Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Capital Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. So Kevin Drum over at Mother Jones, he has an interesting chart that he's come up with from the New York State Comptroller's Office, pretty much showing that the last three decades, salaries in New York City's securities industry have really just blown past everyone else. In fact, salaries on Wall Street have risen by considerably more than 11%, while other salaries in the city have gone up just 1.8%, according to his numbers. And in 2010, he says that the average salary of someone in the securities industry, get this, $366,000. While the average private sector job in any other industry was $66,000. That's New York City. So you're talking about the Wall Streeters, $366,000. Everybody else averaged 66 grand. There's a problem there. We have spent way too much time enriching the folks on Wall Street. So Warren Buffett went and did it. I don't know if you saw this today, Jake. The story came out. Warren Buffett came out with his tax returns, and he made exactly $62,855,038. And on that over $62 million, nearly $63 million, he had a taxable income of $39,814,784. And paid a whopping 17.4% tax, just a little under $7 million on his $62 million take. And he paid a payroll tax, and this is part of it that got me. He paid the payroll tax of $15,300, which, of course, is the maximum. So if you made $106,000, or if you made $62 million, you paid $15,300. And I got to be honest, I'm sorry. The answer to our Social Security ill is, you know what, you made $62 million. I think you should pay more, a little bit more. Maybe it's just me being crazy. A little bit more than $15,300. Just me being crazy, I guess. But here again, you know, you're looking at this 17.4%. And, you know, the Republican, Tim Holzkamp, he wanted this. He demanded it. If we're going to make a Buffett rule, we should see it. Well, we've seen it. The head over at Fox, Rupert, old Rupert has not come out with his tax returns yet. Still hoping. I'm not holding my breath, as you can obviously tell. But the Republicans have their own Buffett rule. They're going to introduce their own, their very own, this guy Steve Scalise from Louisiana, along with his buddy Grover Norquist, most powerful man in the state of Pennsylvania. They've come up with their own little Buffett rule, and they're going to put an optional donation box on the IRS form so that, you know, someone like Buffett who wants to pay more taxes, he can check it off. And again, you know, I find it funny that, you know, you're going to do something dumb like this and waste the time of my tax dollars for a little stunt, but it does beg an interesting question. How much should we allow this tax rate to go down? I mean, I keep hearing again and again and again, and if you listen to the debate last night, they kept talking about, let's close loopholes, lower the tax rate. Close loopholes, lower the tax rate. And I've been telling you, 2013, tax reform of 2013, just like 1986. We're going to close a couple of loopholes for a short period of time. We're going to lower the rate down, and the wealthier will get wealthier and wealthier. And Buffett's right. Should he pay more than his secretary? Should he? And I look at what I talked about yesterday, Bank of America. There are two former executives, this Sally Krawcheck and Joe Price. They each got $850,000 in salary and, you know, $5.15 million in stock. And what tax rate did they pay? They paid just about what Buffett paid without doing any tax avoidance. Understand, Buffett did nothing. He had no deductions, did nothing, did no tax avoidance whatsoever. And you look at these, you know, these former executives from Bank of America. Yeah, they're going to end up with what? $6 million and pay 17% tax? Same as their secretaries or the janitor that cleans their room? You look at the CEO of Bank of America, Moynihan. $10 million payout. And he's going to pay under 17% tax because the vast majority of it, 332,000 of it was wages. Or, I mean, 950 of it was wages, 332 with the tax he paid on it. And the rest of it, well, the 9.05 million, that's stock. Here you go. Capital gains. It's great, isn't it? Wouldn't you love to be able to have all, and maybe we all need to be shareholders. Maybe we need to stop earning wages. Maybe we should do away with this wage thing and just tell our employers, pay me in stock so I can cheat on my taxes, so I can have this little loophole. And I hear somebody was telling me today, well, these athletes, they make so much money. Yeah, they make so much money, but you know what? They pay all their taxes because those are wages. Those aren't capital gains. So at least if you're going to have an argument, at least be in the ballpark with the right argument. It's nuts.
Well, you articulated very well exactly why more and more Americans believe the wealthy should pay their fair share. I think you reported on it. A poll came out just recently. It said close to 70% of the American people say yes, the rich should pay their fair share. We should take away these huge tax loopholes for the wealthy. I think that's a losing issue. The Republicans, you know, they might get their big donors to give them money, but in the long run, that's a losing issue for the Republican Party.
And good for them. But, you know, I love Herman Cain. I love the Herman Cain train. When asked about his 999 plan, said it's gonna hurt poor people. Well, maybe they should buy used stuff because we don't tax used stuff. Go out and buy some used stuff and buy my pizza. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Mike Crossey, president of the PSEA. Stick around. We're right back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin's worker uprising goes on the offense as the recall against Governor Scott Walker kicks off. Jesse Russell reports.
A kickoff date for the recall effort against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has officially been set. The main group coordinating the effort is United Wisconsin, and they announced on Tuesday that November 15th will be the official start date of collecting signatures. Supporters of the governor have said any recall attempt will be disruptive to the state and create chaos. Ryan Lawler from Unia, Wisconsin, disagreed, stating that the chaos started with Walker's budget repair bill.
The introduction of the budget repair bill and the damage that that repair bill and the policies that Governor Walker had proposed ran through the legislation, wreaking far more havoc on what is just a part of the political landscape, the recall process.
Contrary to claims that the recall effort is limited to the state's liberal stronghold of Madison, United Wisconsin said they're working with grassroots recall groups throughout the state.
There's a number of different grassroots groups representing basically the entire geography of Wisconsin.
United Wisconsin doesn't see the desire to recall the governor waning in the state, even 7 months since the largest protest rally. United Wisconsin's Kevin Straka.
There are other formidable drivers such as health care, education, voter ID, tuition increases, etc.
The Occupy protest movement continues to grow as police in Washington, D.C. and Boston arrest some Occupy protesters. About 120 people were arrested in Boston for allegedly refusing an order to leave. Occupy Boston spokesperson Philip Anderson told the Boston Globe,
200 police in riot gear moved in. It got kind of brutal. Veterans, union workers, students were thrown to the ground, put in headlocks, dragged across the ground. Some people injured themselves. 100 plus people got arrested. That included medics, that included legal observers, that included ranking members of the National Lawyers Guild.
Occupy Wall Street expressed its solidarity with their Boston brothers and sisters and commended them for asserting the right of the people to peacefully assemble. In Washington, D.C., at least 6 Occupy D.C. protesters were arrested as they tried to unfurl banners in the Hart office building to urge the Senate to pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. SEIU and Interfaith Worker Justice held a prayer vigil at the Senate Tuesday as it appeared Democrats could not muster the 60 votes they need to pass the Jobs Act. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the way it is. Gasoline, groceries, and our babies. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, you can also email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So, as I talked about earlier, the governor's got his plan to, I shouldn't even call it a plan, it's a scheme. We want to privatize education, evidently, profitize it. And the profitizers were all over the airwaves today talking about those crummy teachers, and we all know who they are. Again, you know, I'm just amazed at how at ease they are with destroying the institutions in our country. Just amazing stuff. But anyway, here to talk about this education scheme is the president of the PSEA, Mike Crossey. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, it's a pleasure to join you always.
You know, I look at this and in no time in this plan that Corbett has put out does he talk about how we fix the problems that exist and maintain the high quality of education that we have across this state. To me, it seems like, hey, let's just tear it down.
You're exactly right. We listened to the governor yesterday, and we're hoping that he would join us in supporting reforms at work and, celebrating the excellence we do have in our public schools. But in those schools that are still struggling, we've actually published a report that's called Solutions at Work, to help take care of those, districts and those buildings where success isn't where it should be. We were hoping the governor would come out and endorse some of those, projects. But what we heard was more of the same. We were hoping he was going to come out and say he was going to use the surplus funds of the state to restore some of the funding he cut back in his first budget. But instead, what we heard was more vouchers, more tax cuts, unfettered expansion of charter schools, And, you know, then we're going to blame the teachers for all the problems that do exist. And it's a shame because my first thing in office September 1st was I wrote a letter to the governor saying, you know, the budget cuts hurt, but, you know, let's figure out a way to work together for the best interests of the students.
Absolutely. And, of course, if anyone wants to read the Solutions That Work paper, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com, or you can go to solutionsthatworkpa.org to take a look at that. You brought up the funding cuts, $860 million, and that's not even as deep as this governor wanted to go. As I remember, it was close to $1 billion he wanted to gut out of public education.
Right. It was actually $1.2 billion. Is what he wanted to cut out of it. The legislature, when they got their hands on the budget, went along with most of his cuts, but they did restore some of the funding, and the final cuts were $860 million.
Just absolutely amazing. And you go, I listened to this frame, the NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, they sent out their press release yesterday. And, you know, again, the right-wing frame of, well, you know, spending isn't going to fix this problem because we spend too much already, but we can't allow kids to remain prisoners. And again, I listen to this kind of rhetoric and this kind of this inflammatory language that comes out of the profiteers. Someone like Matt Briette at the Commonwealth Foundation talking about crummy schools and crummy teachers, and it infuriates me because, look, I know a lot of good teachers. I know a lot of people who put their lives into educating children, and I can't imagine how I would feel if I dedicated my life to something and had some phony think tank had come out and call me a crummy teacher and say that somehow my profession's full of no goodniks.
I agree. It angers you, but what we're trying to do is we're trying to stay at the table. We're trying to stay engaged in the debate, and let's somehow force them to talk about the real issues. And you know, the biggest issue on the plate right now is how do we restore that funding to our schools? Not the union, but the Pennsylvania school business officials did a survey of 500 school districts that we have here in the state. And what they found was that as a result of the budget cuts from the governor, was that 70% of the school districts out there, the surveys of the school districts that responded to the survey, and it was over half of them that did respond, a very good response, but over 70% of those school districts increased class sizes, 44% of those school districts reduced electives that the students could take, 35% have already cut out tutoring programs, 20% have already eliminated summer school, 72% had to dig into the reserve funds. And, while the governor said that, you know, he was not going to raise taxes, 20% of the school districts in the state have already raised their property taxes to, try to get through this governor's budget. 58% of the school districts have reduced, purchasing technology for their students. This is just the wrong way to go, and you mentioned it very, very nicely there that, you know, not only are the educators in the schools working really hard, but our Pennsylvania schools are doing extremely well. Last year, the measure that they like to use are test scores, which is not the only way to measure anything we know, but 93% of the school districts in Pennsylvania made AYP last year. That's adequate yearly progress. And that's just an outstanding. It's one of the highest in the nation. And, you know, we have the student achievement to support our claims that public education in Pennsylvania works. It works very well. We're number one in the nation in reading at the eighth grade level. We're also tops in the nation at the fourth grade level, and we're tops in the nation at both levels that are measured in mathematics. 70% of the students in Pennsylvania go on to higher education.
Well, wow, that's not bad considering we got all those crummy, greedy teachers.
That's right.
Because you listen, I listened to right wing radio today, and that was the frame. It was everything that came out of the mouth is these greedy, crummy teachers, and they're no good, and we need to get rid of them. And the only way to do this is to profitize it. put this into hands of charter schools. And let me ask you, you know, we've expanded this charter. This is what he wants to do, expand it to where we'll have charter schools everywhere. Is there any documentation that says this is the cure-all, this is the silver bullet? Has anyone done any studies on saying, hey, charter schools are either the cat's meow or maybe that's not so great? Anything?
Well, the surveys that are out there say just the opposite. A study was done by Stanford University that said that the majority of charter schools in Pennsylvania do less well than the school district and the traditional school districts. A study that's most often quoted, though, I believe, is out of Princeton University, and they actually did a nationwide study. And if I remember correctly, the figures were 17% of charter schools do better than public schools, 46% of them do about the same as public schools, and 37% of them do worse. It seems to me that you're looking at 83% of the charter schools out there do not do as well as our public schools. I'm not going to invest in something that's 83% wrong.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, and I don't want my tax dollars going to profitizing this. This is a public good. This is something that we the people should do for our children, and there should be no profit motive here. And I guess I just have a problem with that you're going to end up. And I look at the higher education system. I look at the big for-profit universities who are paying their CEOs in the tens of millions of dollars, and they're churning out non-graduates with massive amounts of debt. And they don't really care what happens to them. That's what bothers me, that we're going to turn, K through 12 into what we've done to higher education.
And that would obviously be terribly wrong. And you're right. That's what they're looking at doing here. The governor tried to do the same thing with higher education here in Pennsylvania. The governor's budget proposed cutting 50% of the higher education funding here in the state. It ended up, after negotiations with the legislature, it ended up receiving cuts of about 20%. But still, every college student in the state is looking at higher tuition scores. And we're just going in the wrong direction here in Pennsylvania. And somehow we've got to get them to think about that and get them to turn it around and go the other direction and do what works for kids instead of what hurts kids.
Last bit of questioning I've got for you. I look at I'm dead set against it. Virtually everyone I know, dead set against it. They look at the public school education that they got. They look at the public education that their children are getting, and they're happy with it. People in the state of Pennsylvania, I cannot imagine, are in favor of profitizing and privatizing something that is worked for them, working for their children. I just don't see them going to this lottery ticket. Have you guys done any polling, or is there anything out there that says where the people here in the state fall on this voucher plan?
We absolutely have. Actually, we didn't do it because we didn't want it to come out of the union, we went together with some others and went with Dr. Terry Madonna, who is probably one of the most respected pollsters here in the state of Pennsylvania. And he did a study, survey of Pennsylvania voters here in Pennsylvania. And what he found was that by a 2-to-1 margin, Pennsylvanians opposed the recent funding cuts to the Commonwealth's public schools. He did some other things here too. Let me think about what they were. 69% of the residents opposed the cuts to the budget. 88% of the public agreed with us that reduced class sizes was the wrong way to go, that individualized student attention and tutoring helped students, 89%. That programs to help make schools safer, 85%. Pre- and full-day kindergarten, 73%. And then you turn around and you look at the governor's voucher proposal, which is his number one proposal. I believe it was 59% said they were strongly opposed or opposed to vouchers. So the public is solidly, the average citizen, the public in Pennsylvania,
knows what's best for their schools. And, knows that our schools are doing a good job. I'm just shocked that, you know, the governor wants to take us in the other direction.
So what should people be doing? I mean, I'm a big fan of getting on the phone and complaining and, you know, carrying on. What do we do?
Well, the best thing we can do right now is contact our legislators and let them know that, cause this proposal is in the hands of the legislators now. Let your state rep, let your state senator know that the governor's plan is wrong. And tell them to use, it's a simple phrase, solutions at work. The legislators know what that program is. I sent a letter to every legislator last week, and I mailed them a personal copy of Solutions at Work. And I'm not asking for anything for the union. What I'm asking for is to do what's right for kids.
Absolutely. And again, if you want to read the Solutions That Work paper, solutionsthatworkpa.org is the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mike Grossi's name. Mike, I appreciate the time. I'd love to have you back again as this moves down the path.
Anytime at all, Rick. I'd love to join you and your audience.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Show. Gather round, children, and I'll tell you another fairy tale. But I must warn you, this one is really, really scary. So hold on to each other. It's about Rick Perry, the swaggering Texas governor who wants very, very much to be the Republican nominee for president. So, to get Republican primary voters to like him, he has been riding all across the country on a big horse he calls Money, claiming that he will save people everywhere by shooting down the horror of RomneyCare. What's that, you ask? It's the Massachusetts Health Insurance Plan, developed by Ramblin' Rick's presidential rival, Mitt Romney. Why is it dangerous? Because, explains Perry, it is, quote, the model for socialized medicine. Big bad government should not be involved in health care, he shouts at Republican rallies, declaring that the sainted free market is the best provider of insurance. That's how we do it in Texas, he brags, and here comes the scary part. I'll bring the Texas model to all of America. Hoo boy, that would not be nice or healthy. Under Pericare, more than 6 million Texans, including 1.3 million children, are left with no health coverage at all, the highest rate of uninsured residents in the country. Also, the price that people must pay for insurance has nearly doubled under Perry's reign. And he has slashed state spending and curbed eligibility for programs to help hard-hit families get health services, including cutting 200,000 Texas children out of a program to assure that low-income youngsters get health care. So, children, beware of yee-hawing Texas politicos spreading tales of free market miracles. Texans themselves find nothing miraculous about Pericare, referring to it as the yo-yo plan. You're on your own. This is Jim Hightower saying, luckily though, people can write their own happy ending to this scary fairy tale. Just don't vote for it.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. So earlier this afternoon, it happened. The bipartisan, if you will, and again, there's nothing bipartisan about it. There's, when it comes to trade issues, there is one party. There's the Wall Street party. There's the wealth class party. There's the pro-business party. That's it. Has nothing to do with Democrats, Republicans, virtually nothing. So the House of Representatives approved all three free trade agreements that Obama put forth, Colombia, Panama, South Korea, and by pretty wide margins. Colombia, in the House, went through 262 to 167. You had 31 Democrats voting for it. Panama got the most votes in the House, 300 to 129. 66 Democrats jumped for it. South Korea, 278 to 151. 59 Democrats for it. The Trade Adjustment Assistance Program overwhelmingly passed, 307 to 122. So here again, you're looking at the Republican Party split down the middle on that issue. 118 voted for it, 122 against it. All the Democrats supported the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program because I think everybody knows we're going to lose tons of jobs because of these agreements. Now, in the Senate, again, big margins in the Senate. South Korea got a vote of 83 to 15. Panama, Colombia, each 77-22. So again, all the free trade agreements, lock, stock, really no argument. I think the Sherrod Brown from Ohio put it best. These agreements are supposed to be about lowering tariffs. Yet here, the Panamanian free trade agreement is 1,600 pages long. Like you said, if this was really about lowering tariffs, it would be about 3 pages long. We're lowering the tariffs. What it is, what these agreements are, protecting the investor class, protecting the wealth class going and tearing down capital borders, allowing Wall Street to get into the market there in South Korea. So here again, what gets me about these agreements, and it's just plain nuts. Drives me absolutely ballistic, is there was really no opposition. And it's frustrating on so many levels because I think the American people get it. I think people understand that these free trade agreements are doing nothing but harming us. And I know a lot of the people said, it creates a job here, but how many are we going to lose? And you look at NAFTA. NAFTA was a job killer. We lost over 1 million jobs because of NAFTA. And now none of these agreements are the NAFTA size, But here again, more of the same failed ideas. Look, I've got no problem with trading with people. Trade's actually a pretty good thing. Gets me what I need, gets you what we need. It's not a bad idea when it's done right. This idea that we can, open the borders and dump the tariffs, no problem. We'll fix it right up. Who loses? Well, you and I lose. You and I continue to lose time and time again. Just how it is. And when will it end? And you look at the jobs bill. The whole jobs bill that they wanted to fight over. The Democrats couldn't get it passed through. 63% of the people say, we want that jobs bill. Why can't we get that through? Why can't we get that kind of bipartisan support to get a jobs bill pushed through? Nope, can't do that. No. Bad idea. It's just nuts. And what do we do with China? Nothing. China's fine. How many people saw the debate? I didn't watch it. I watched a bunch of clips from it. But Rick Santorum, you gotta love desperation. You gotta love this guy. They were talking about a trade war with China. If we do this currency thing, it's gonna cause a trade war. Well, Romney goes, hey, look. Day one, I'm going to declare them a trade manipulator. I'm going to go after it. I'm going to make sure that, we hold them accountable. And he said, look, I don't want a trade war with anyone, but we're going to protect ourselves. So Santorum jumps in. He goes, Mitt, I don't want to go to trade war. I don't want to go to a trade war. He said, but I want to beat China. I want to go to war with China and make America the most attractive place to do business. So he doesn't want to go to a trade war, or he does. I'm not really sure where Tricky Ricky is on this again. But when I look at this, and what's frustrating, China has been lobbying our government. And we must be one of the few governments in the world that allow anyone to come in and directly lobby our congressman. In fact, the Chinese government has been hiring, the big blue chip Washington law firms, $35,000 a month to go in there and lobby Congress. And you go, $35,000 a month, that's a lot of money. Not when you consider the massive trade deficit we have. You know, they're going to throw a couple of pennies on the table to save the billions that they're taking in. And they understand what this means. If they cannot continue to undervalue their currency, if they cannot continue to hold down the value of their currency, their products will become more expensive. And then our products will become more competitive because, and people may actually start buying American products. And people may actually start manufacturing them. Instead of saying, well, you know, there's this great advantage in China where we can exploit their labor, we can do all kinds of stuff. Maybe if you put an end to that, maybe we have high road policies. I would much rather have a high road policy where we're talking about how we create full employment. I would much rather have a way of how we're going to make everybody's standard of living better instead of tearing it down. And I look at my buddy Herman Cain, and you got to love the Herman Cain train. This idea of going out and buying used goods. Yeah, go buy that used milk or buy that used loaf of bread there, Herman. Let's see you work on that. Yeah, he actually answered the question. You know, well, you know, it's not going to hurt poor people because those poor people go out and buy used goods. It's nuts. But he's been out there, and look, you got to give Hermie credit. Herman understands marketing. Herman understands simple-minded messaging. He gets it. $9.99. Same price you can get a pizza. $9.99. That's the plan. It's catchy. It sticks. It's easily repetitive. In fact, in the one thing that I saw, they said in the speech that he gave, he said $9.99 85 times. Because we're stupid. And we take to those little sound bites. We take to those little snippets. 999. It's a 999 plan. It's a 999 plan. A 99.99. It works. 9% individual flat tax. 9% business flat tax. 9% sales tax. It's a wonderful plan. Simple stuff. Only problem is, it's a failure. It's an absolute failure, and it will bankrupt this country, which again is the plan. And the folks over at Think Progress did a nice little markup. Went back and said, okay, let's look at the year 2007. Because we have all of the information for the year 2007. And let us use the 999 plan. Let's use the Herman Cain plan. And let's see how it works. So in 2007, the total adjustable gross income on all income returns was $8.7 trillion. Okay, $8.7 trillion. And now since the Herman Cain train plan would do away with investment income, so all, you know, that capital gains, all of the, you know, the your bank interest, all that stuff would be exempt. You would have nothing but taxable income, you know, your wages. And that would bring that $8.7 trillion down to $7.4 trillion. So if we do this 9999 plan, we would have a pretty big hole. And what they went through is they went through the flat tax idea. And they looked at all the sales that happened. And they said, okay, if we add this, we take this 9%, that 9% sales tax, federal sales tax, not, and it has nothing to do with the 6-7% or 8% in some states, state sales tax. The 9%'s on top of that. That 9% flat tax would have brought in about $665 billion in income. Now they went and they looked at the corporate tax rate, which was $1.3 trillion, which is what they reported, what they brought in. The 9% flat tax would have brought in $112 billion. So it actually brought in $1.3 trillion. The Cain plan of 9% brought in $112 billion. So you're going from $1.3 trillion down to $112 billion. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing stuff. Now, the sales tax part of this, the first part, I'm sorry, was income tax. The second part of this, the sales tax, would generate about $500 billion. So you do the math, you add that all up, and you come up with a nice number, about $1.3 trillion. That's your total tax revenue. It sounds like a lot of money. But the reality is it's only half of the money that they took in 2007. So you're looking at a massive revenue shortfall. And how does he plan to raise that? because you cannot cut enough to get down to that level. You just can't do it. They're trying to cut $1.5 trillion in spending in this big committee. He's cutting $1.3 trillion in revenue coming in. Does it make any sense to you? But it sounds good, doesn't it? It's the 999 plan. It's simple, it's easy, and in the most uneducated can understand it. But when you get into the numbers, and I got to give Michelle Bachmann credit, when you turn 999 upside down, it's 666. The devil's in the details. And the details, massive debt. But here again, it's not about that. It's about destroying our government. It's about destroying our ability to respond to crisis. It's about destroying our ability to meet the needs of those less fortunate, meet the needs of our students. And it's all about feeding the investor class. Simple stuff. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about, you got to love this story from Tennessee. You got to hear this. Stick around. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Scott Right Wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So this Tennessee state representative, a guy named Curry Todd, a Republican, he sponsored a bill, and we talked about this. He was the guy who sponsored the bill that said, yeah, go ahead. Take your gun into the bar with you. Hey, well, that's what we need. We need more liquor and guns. We need more drunken people shooting at each other. Yeah, that's what we need. Went through and they passed it. Originally, it was found unconstitutional because, it was written originally in 2009 that you could take your gun with you, but you had to promise not to drink. Somehow that was ruled unconstitutional. But last year, an updated version passed. So now it's perfectly legal for you to take your gun to the bar with you. Make sure you got your firearm with you at all time. Well, it turns out Representative Curry Todd, Well, he was pulled over about 11:15 p.m. in Nashville, according to the TV station WSMV, and also had a loaded Smith & Wesson 38 special hidden between the driver's seat and the center console. He was arrested, law is pretty clear, evidently, according to the lawmakers, because the cop said, the guy was basically falling down all the time. And according to the affidavit that is where the cops charged him, the very obviously impaired gentleman should not in any condition be carrying a loaded handgun. He is being held on $3,000 bond in the Metro jail. So good for him. I'm glad that law worked out for you. Not as bad as the guy in Florida who, wanted to make, having sex in a bathroom with other men a felony, and then getting caught having sex with a large black man in a bathroom because he was scared. There was thunder outside, and he ran into the bathroom because he was scared, and he saw a very large black man, and he was scared, so he offered to pay him for sex. Because generally, that's the first thing I think of when I'm scared. Yeah. And good for him. Isn't it the first thing you think of?
I'm not too sure when I answer that question, right? But no, that's not the first thing.
Oh, I was worried because if you weren't willing to answer it, I'm going, maybe I've gone too far and maybe it is something you'd consider. Okay.
No.
All right.
Not really.
Well, hey, that's your personal life. Nothing against it.
Uh-huh.
You do what you got to do. Whatever keeps you from carrying guns into bars and shooting people. Whatever you got to do. But it brings me back to what's going on here in the state of Pennsylvania. I mean, we're talking about let's privatize liquor stores and let's do all of this privatization and all of this stuff. And I've been thinking about it and I'm going, you know what? I think I'm going to embrace the whole, we should be like Mississippi or Georgia. We should just, since we're heading that way anyway, let's just put the pedal to the metal. Let's go all the way. Let's deregulate. Let's privatize. Let's dump it all. Get rid of all those rules so we can have freedom like we used to. We can have shootouts in the middle of the street. Good idea, right? Come on with me. We can do this. We should allow all the big box retailers and all the grocery stores and convenience stores to sell all the wine, all the liquor, and all the beer they want to sell. In fact, what they can do, they can put it right next to the pharmacy and do away with all those regulations on drug laws. Get rid of all that pharmacy stuff. Let the big pharmacy sell eight balls. Let them sell some speed balls. You want to fix our tax problems? Let's just start selling drugs right next to the beer and wine and liquor. And in fact, while you're at the Walmart or the Giant, why not just make it your one vice stop? Just make it that one vice stop and shop. Get your booze, get your drugs, and while you're there, get a couple of those lottery tickets. Maybe play a couple of slots while you're in line. What the heck? I have a betting window as well, so you can put a bet down on the ponies and maybe even the big game. What the heck? Let's do that. Good night, family values, people. Yeah, let's do it all. Well, maybe not. Because I don't know that I want to live in that kind of society. I've been to Vegas. I'm not there with you. I'm just not. Anyway, let's talk about some more family values. I love our friends in the Family Values Party. They're such good people. Last week, you may remember us talking about the House of Representatives. The Republicans decided that they're going to go after women again. And this has been an ongoing theme with Republicans. They seem to not like women very much. So they've proposed a House Resolution 358, what they're calling the Protect Life Act. Now, the opponents are calling it Let Women Die Act. So I guess it depends on your perspective. And what the Republican Protect Life Act would do is it would allow hospitals who get federal money to turn women away who need an abortion to save their life. Under current law, every hospital that takes any federal money, be it Medicare, be it Medicaid, they are legally bound to save the patient. And if that means they have to perform an abortion to save the life of the mother, they have to do that. That is the law. Well, we've got a guy in this listening area, a Republican by the name of Joe Pitts, who sponsored this H.R. 358, the Protect Life Act. And he's basically saying, you know what? You hospitals, you bishops, you religious folks, you can decide. You can decide what services you're going to provide. And to me, I look at this bill. This is the problem with privatized health care. This is the problem when you move to a theocracy. Do we want bishops who know nothing about health care making decisions for my life? Do I really want to have a bishop between me and my doctor? Do I want to have a theocrat between me and my doctor? Do I want to have this nitwit Pitts between me and my doctor? And I know my teach-wit friends are going to go, oh, well, Rick, you want Obamacare between you and your doctor. No, ding-dong. In fact, most of what was between me and my doctor, thanks to Obamacare, has been removed. Oh, like the rescission, like the pre-existing conditions. Because you know, there are times I go to my doctor and I go, you know what? I don't know that I can really tell him that this happened because, oh, he might write it down. And then if something happens again, oh, that's a pre-existing condition because you changed jobs. That's what's going on here. And when I read this thing by Pitts, I remembered a friend of mine whose wife, she was pregnant and really heavily Catholic. I mean, really, the heavy Catholic, the really repressed, the real, you know what I'm talking about. And turns out that they didn't know what. There was no baby there. She was gonna go to term. She was gonna deliver something, but it wasn't going to be a child. And I remember hearing the conversation of how difficult it was to find a hospital that would actually do the procedure to clean it out, because they had to do something called the DNC, which is basically an abortion. It goes in, it cleans everything out, because there's nothing there. And I remember in this conversation, I remember having someone say, well, she should have to deliver that because, that's the way it should be. And I'm going, really, you would put someone through that stressful time to deliver something that would scar them for life? Really? And that's what happens when you put theocrats in charge. When you put people who are more concerned about we gotta sanctify the religion. I mean, that's what scares me. And I see someone like Pitts putting something like this out, and this is the reason you got to get rid of Pitts, honestly and truthfully. And you want to talk about more family values? This is Family Values Hours. Come on, kids. Gather around the radio for Family Values Hour, Republican style. The City Council of Topeka, Kansas, by a vote of 7-3 yesterday, they voted to repeal the local law that makes domestic violence a crime. Because evidently, decriminalizing domestic violence, so wife beating, no longer a crime. In fact, wife beating, that's not going to be a sport in Topeka, Kansas, because nobody will prosecute these crimes. So they've decided, well, we're going to make it a cost-cutting measure, because nobody really wants to prosecute this stuff. We don't want to put the guys in jail. That's a family matter. How many of my older listeners remember when domestic abuse was a family matter? Do you get the feeling we're going backward? Do you get the feeling we're ending up back in the 50s where women were barefoot pregnant, stuck in the house? Because, you need to take care of that in the home. We don't need to get the police involved. It's scary stuff. So I guess I should make the announcement official. Attention, wife beaters. Topeka, Kansas, your new home for Right On from now on, because evidently wife beating is a new sport there, and you don't have to worry about it. And I might as well finish up with the bill we talked about. I think it was last week for a minute. Another one of these ironic pieces of legislation. And really, I guess, fitting for the month of October. Because the month of October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I didn't know it either. Now I'm telling you. Turns out, Representative Lamar Smith, good family values Republican from Texas, he has come up with the Hinder under the Administration Legalization Temptation Act. I don't even know what that means. But I'm sure it means something. He's calling it HALT. And what HALT will do, look, they want any immigrants they can find, they want to throw them out of the country. That's the idea. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt for not being too big of an a-hole, but just about a little bit, that he wants all immigrants out, and he doesn't want the Obama administration to do what Reagan did and give people amnesty. There's the benefit of the doubt. Here's what this idiot wants to do, though. Part of this bill is any illegal immigrant, anyone here who's in an undocumented fashion, who calls the police and says, hey, this guy, be it an American, be it a foreigner, be it anybody, this guy's beating me up. Help me. The police will come. Oh, yes, they will. The police will come, and the woman who is beaten, the undocumented woman beaten, will be deported. So congratulations, you just reported yourself out of the country. And that, again, good, solid family values. You got to love the family values, people. You really do. And when we come back, a little bit more family values. Since it seems to be Family Values Hour, you got to love Florida. This story from Florida will make all of the Rick Perry fans oh so very happy and all tingly in the panties. Stick around. You got to hear this. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280, or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Absence works. Maybe it's the way it's being taught or the way that it's being applied out there. But the fact of the matter is, it is the best form of to teach our children.
I want to be a cowboy.
I got to tell you, the best thing that's happened is that doofus has really run probably the worst campaign. I think Martha Coakley is going, I got a shot of redeeming myself. I mean, maybe Martha's dancing up in Massachusetts, because I still think they're going to be studying that campaign for generations. But what Perry's done has just been, Wow, just bad. Just bad all around. So, you know, I was talking about, the family values people, our Republican friends. And down in Florida, there's this state representative, Brad Drake, from Ukanana. Yeah, you figure that out. He proposed a bill yesterday that, you know, we don't want to do lethal injection anymore. No more lethal injection in the state of Florida because it's too humane. No, it's too nice. He said, I'm sick and tired of this sensitivity movement for criminals. Every time there's a warrant execution, there's a warranted execution, this is about to take place, some man or woman is standing on the corner holding a sign, yelling and screaming for humane treatment. Yeah, you know those Christian people. How dare they? He said, I have no desire to humanely respect those that are inhumane. And again, a very, very Christian thing to say. From our representative from Florida. He has proposed doing away with lethal injection and bringing back the electric chair and firing squads. And you know what? There are some out there who, you know what? They would be all in favor of it. And I can't, in the coming days, I'm going to try and reach out to some of my really hyper Christian friends. You know, the people who used to be decent for your folks when they were drinking and doing drugs, but then they like Glenn Beck, found religion and now are, well, not so much. And I really want their opinion on this whole, do we treat people humanely, even if they've been really scumbags, even if they've done the most heinous thing? And what does it say about us as a people? So I'm kind of interested about that. Also, speaking of family values, since I seem to be on a family values kick, remember Joe Walsh, the representative from Illinois, the Tea Party Republican? And I've been following this for a while. Evidently, he just decided, you know, a couple of years ago, I'm not going to pay child support, so I'll owe my kid $117,000 plus interest. Well, he's come out now. And you gotta love this. He's come out now and he says that, well, the reason he stopped paying child support is because he reached a verbal agreement 3 years ago that he could stop paying child support. Does that make sense to you? I mean, I stop and think about how difficult it was for my mother, a single mother, to raise me. I stop and think about all of the single women that I know and that I've known through my life who have had someone like this run off or through a divorce, that, you know, something happens, and they end up with a deadbeat who refuses to pay and refuses to help support their child, and they suffer. And along with the woman suffering, the child suffers. I have absolutely zero respect for this guy. Absolutely nothing. You know, I am so, every time I hear stories like this, because it was difficult for my mother and it was difficult for me. I remember going without. I remember going to the cupboards and there being nothing. I remember having clothes that my pants were floods because they were up to the middle of my calf because my mother couldn't afford to buy new ones because there was no father paying into my care. He was off being a deadbeat somewhere else, doing who knows what, not taking care of his responsibility. Look, you know, anyone can sire a child, but it takes a real man, a real strong human being to actually stand by and raise that child. And I have no respect for this T-twit. And I hope the folks of Illinois, I hope the people in his district go, you know what? Had we known this when you were running, no way in a cold day in Hades would we elect a deadbeat. You know, where are all the Republicans? And this is, where are my T-twits? Where are the Republicans who love to point at the Democrats who have tax problems or the Democrats who do dumb things, who I beat up on as well? Where are the Republicans going, this guy's a deadbeat? Pay up, deadbeat. Where are they? I would love to hear a Republican give me a justification why we're not, why you're not, why your party hasn't ostracized this guy for being an absolute no good for nothing deadbeat. Can you figure it out, Jake? Because I cannot. I've heard nothing from the leadership. I've heard nothing from the party. I've heard nothing. In fact, you don't see stories in the mainstream media. I got to dig this stuff up.
This is just another in a long line of offenses committed by the Republicans that go against the family values that they preach. I mean, can you say hypocrite with a capital H? I mean, how many congressmen have we caught having extramarital affairs or having homosexual affairs, or as in the case of Congressman Walsh, a deadbeat dad? And I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard anything on the Hill. I haven't heard really any bad publicity.
So basically,
it's amazing.
As this story goes, the guy was basically a loser. He was a loser. Couldn't find a job. Was working this or that, whatever. Decided, hey, I'm big in the Tea Party movement. And a couple of people said, hey, Joe, run for Congress. Maybe you'll get a job finally. So he wins. And the wife, she said nobody thought he was going to win. So, then we find out, according to her, that he lent him his own campaign $35,000 without paying to help raise his child for years. And she said, you know what? You're damn right I want some of that money. I've been raising his responsibility now for all these years. He should pay for it.
Well, I wonder if she used any assistance programs. It'd be very interesting to find out.
Yeah, and I'm hoping some journalist looks into that, because I was thinking that this afternoon. How much tax money? Did she collect any welfare? Did she get any LIHEAP, any assistance whatsoever to help raise his kid? It's. I mean, does it make sense to you? And I guess I'm extra sensitive about this because my father was a deadbeat. And I saw how difficult it was on my mother. And I've seen so many other kids that I grew up with who were in the same boat. The father just fled. And there was never anything coming back. There was no support. There was no guidance. There was nothing. And I look at this guy and I go, he is the epitome of deadbeat. He should actually be in jail. That's where he belongs. But again, it's the Republican hypocrisy. They're not going to go after it. Anyway, I'm going to take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to talk with David Bacon. He's a photojournalist and author. Going to talk about these trade agreements and what's going on with this and how it's going to affect people into the future. And maybe look back a little bit at the NAFTA agreement and what the promises were from that era. We were told it's going to bring wealth and prosperity to us all. Now look what it's done. We're right back after this.
I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'm an announcer winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
Fellow working class heroes, I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin's worker uprising goes on the offense as the recall against Governor Scott Walker kicks off. Jesse Russell reports.
A kickoff date for the recall effort against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has officially been set. The main group coordinating the effort is United Wisconsin, and they announced on Tuesday that November 15th will be the official start date of collecting signatures. Supporters of the governor have said any recall attempt will be disruptive to the state and create chaos. Ryan Lawler from United Wisconsin disagreed, stating that the chaos started with Walker's budget repair bill.
The introduction of the budget repair bill and the damage that that repair bill and the policies that Governor Walker had proposed ran through the legislation, wreaking far more havoc on what is just a part of the political landscape, the recall process.
Contrary to claims that the recall effort is limited to the state's liberal stronghold of Madison, United Wisconsin said they're working with grassroots recall groups throughout the state.
There's a number of different grassroots groups representing basically the entire geography of Wisconsin.
United Wisconsin doesn't see the desire to recall the governor waning in the state, even 7 months since the largest protest rally. United Wisconsin's Kevin Straka.
There are other formidable drivers such as health care, education, voter ID, tuition increases, etc.
The Occupy protest movement continues to grow as police in Washington, D.C. and Boston arrest some Occupy protesters. About 120 people were arrested in Boston for allegedly refusing an order to leave. Occupy Boston spokesperson Philip Anderson told the Boston Globe,
200 police in riot gear moved in. It got kind of brutal. Veterans, union workers, students were thrown to the ground, put in headlocks, dragged across the ground. Some people injured themselves. 100 plus people got arrested. That included medics, that included legal observers, that included ranking members of the National Lawyers Guild.
Occupy Wall Street expressed its solidarity with their Boston brothers and sisters and commended them for asserting the right of the people to peacefully assemble. In Washington, D.C., at least six Occupy D.C. protesters were arrested as they tried to unfurl banners in the Hart office building to urge the Senate to pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. SEIU and Interfaith Worker Justice held a prayer vigil at the Senate Tuesday as it appeared Democrats could not muster the 60 votes they need to pass the Jobs Act. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech. Take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
I look at what happened today. You know, again, the one-party rule, if you will, when it comes to trade issues. Overwhelmingly supported by both parties, these trade agreements, Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. South Korea got the most votes in the Senate, but, you know, Colombia and Panama, 77 votes in favor, 22 opposed. What can you say? Anyway, here to help us work through some of that, maybe look a little bit back at NAFTA and maybe predict where we're going with this is David Bacon. He's a photojournalist and author, does some great photography. David, thanks for taking time for me.
It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
You know, I look at these three free trade agreements, and I can't help but think we're going to lose tens of thousands of jobs over this.
Well, that's a pretty good bet, I think, because we've been here before, as you said. We can look at the experience of NAFTA and see what NAFTA did, because these trade agreements are essentially, they're not only modeled on NAFTA, the one with Panama is virtually identical to it. The ones with Korea and Colombia are really not different in any significant way. So if you want, we could look at the record here. Do you want to look at the record of NAFTA?
Absolutely, and you've written a piece, Free Trade Agreements, Killing Jobs and Labor Rights, over at truthout.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com if you want to read it. But, you know, a couple of promises were made. So, you know, we were told it was going to create jobs. Did it?
No, it did not. You know, the promise, you know, we saw a lot of big corporations walking the hill in 1992 making these promises, you know, General Electric being, you know, number one among all of them. Actually, Jack Welch, who was at the time the head of General Electric, said that Mexico, that the future of General Electric as a corporation lay in Mexico, and but they said that we would get jobs out of the agreement. One study, for instance, predicted that we were going to get 130,000 jobs in 2 years. They also said that Mexicans would get jobs because, you know, a lot of the production obviously was going to be moved south. What actually happened? Well, our trade deficit with Mexico ballooned to over $100 billion in less than 15 years. That translates into the loss of over a million jobs. This is according to the Economic Policy Institute, which is the organization of economists in Washington that research economic issues, especially from a working class kind of perspective. They also pointed out that here in California, where I live, we lost 123,000 jobs. So, you know, NAFTA was a really big job killer.
Well, for us it was. So what you're saying, that we lost all these jobs, over a million jobs, so it had to be good for Mexico, right? Because those jobs went somewhere. And if I remember Thomas Friedman right, saying, you know, we're going to have this great leveling off, you know, everyone's going to, we're going to raise up Mexico. We may drop a little bit, but we're going to bring them out of poverty and we're going to create consumers out of them, right?
That's right. And it wasn't just Thomas Friedman. Clinton said that. The president of Mexico at the time, Carlos Salinas, Mexico's most corrupt president, toured the U.S., saying, if you don't like migration from Mexico, vote for this trade agreement because it's going to raise living standards in Mexico. It'll produce jobs for Mexicans. He said the same thing to people in Mexico. Well, the net result of that was, first of all, that just in the first year alone, Mexico went into an economic tailspin because of that agreement in large part, and Mexico lost a million jobs in that one. The agreement also allowed big U.S. grain companies like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill to dump grain on the Mexican market. Now, remember, these are corporations that we subsidized through the U.S. Farm Bill. So here we had, you know, corporations that were getting our tax money to lower their production costs, and they used that to take over the Mexican corn market. Well, the net result of that was that 1.3 million Mexican farmers were no longer able to survive growing corn in Mexico. Well, they had to do something to survive, and obviously many of them came north here. In fact, during the period of time when NAFTA's been in effect, 6 million people have come from Mexico to live in the United States, not because, you know, they were necessarily attracted by the high standard of living that people were going to have here, because really almost all of those people are working for minimum wage here, which is, as we know from our own experience here, pretty darn hard to survive on. But surviving in Mexico became virtually impossible because of that kind of dumping. Smithfield Farms, a huge, in fact, the world's largest meatpacking company, headquartered in Virginia, dumped meat on the Mexican market, and they built a hog farm in Mexico that was that had this terrible kind of pollution from the waste from the hogs that is prohibited in the U.S., especially in North Carolina, where they have most of their hog farms in the U.S. North Carolina prohibited them from building new hog farms with these pools of pig excrement. And so they went to Mexico and they built one there. In fact, they built one of the largest hog farms in the world there, and that had the effect of pushing people out of the valley where they built it, both because of the pollution
and the smell,
because of the fact that they were dumping pork on the Mexican market, making it impossible for small farmers to raise pigs in Mexico.
I can't imagine the smell, because there's a pig farm down the road from here and for miles. And we've got pretty good regulations here. For miles, the smell is enough to knock you out. But you know, let me ask you about this, because one of the things that I've found, and one of the things I've been saying for the longest time, is you look at NAFTA, one of the things the Mexican government had to do was actually change their constitution, stripping land away from communities that they used to farm, because that was a subsidy to the farming industry. When I look at
this,
I don't think the average American understands what we've done to that country and why people are here. I mean, I love to think that this is the greatest country on earth. I don't want to be anywhere else. And if I were in Mexico, I'd be working to get here too. But, you know, you look at what we've done. Did we leave them an option?
Well, we closed down an awful lot of options, especially for working people and for farmers in Mexico. And I shouldn't really say we, because it wasn't you, it wasn't me, it wasn't working people in this country that benefited from it. We're talking again about basically huge corporations.
But it was still my country that did this. It was still my country that did this.
Well, yes, we negotiated the treaty. That's true. This is a treaty that came from Wall Street, actually. All those folks who are out there protesting on Wall Street today ought to think about that one. You know, what is it that Wall Street has done in Mexico through these free trade agreements? But you're right. It did also require Mexico to change its basic laws. So, for instance, as you were pointing out, the land reform law in Mexico was changed in order to allow, for instance, big landowners to buy land and to become even larger. Smithfield Farms, when they built that hog farm in Veracruz in Mexico, 20 years earlier, they would not have been able to do that because they could not have bought the land and owned the land in order to do that. But by changing Mexico's land reform laws, they made it possible for essentially very wealthy people and large corporations to become huge landowners in Mexico in much the same way as that they were before the Mexican Revolution. So that was one. But it also, you know, you think that NAFTA, you know, they say about these free trade agreements that they level the playing field, that they're the same rules for everybody, but that is not true. Here we are subsidizing our grain companies, Cargill, Orchard Daniels, Midland, and the rest of them, $2 billion in the last farm bill. Mexico had to stop its subsidies that it used to basically support small farmers in Mexico. Mexico had a program in which they would buy up corn at high prices from small farmers in southern Mexico, and they would turn it into tortillas and sell it in government-run grocery stores in cities for low prices to poor people there. That was declared an unfair barrier to competition under NAFTA. And consequently, the largest retailer in Mexico today is Walmart. And tortilla production is monopolized, and the price of tortillas has tripled since the time that NAFTA went into effect.
Well, there's a good, you know, business solution, a good profitized solution. Let's look at one of the other promises that was made. And, you know, most of the agreement, and this is what I try, this is why I think there's one party rule when it comes to trade, because the vast majority of NAFTA was negotiated during the George H.W. Bush years. In fact, it was about 90% done. Maybe even more than that before Clinton took office. Now he was all in favor of it, but he claimed to throw some labor protections in there, and there was some very weak language thrown in there. But the other promise was that, you know, we're going to create union jobs, we're going to protect the union jobs we've got here. The side agreements was going to make sure that the wages in Mexico go up and that we don't fall too far. How'd that work out for us?
Well, there were two side agreements that were negotiated to NAFTA, one that was supposed to protect labor rights and the other one that was supposed to protect the environment. Well, you take a look at that pig farm in Veracruz and you can see how effective the environmental side agreement was. The labor side agreement was really completely toothless. There were many, many efforts that Mexican workers made, especially in those low-wage factories on the border where people are producing for us, for our market here. Where people tried to organize independent unions and raise those wages. After all, that was the promise of NAFTA, right?
Yep.
That Mexican workers were going to get jobs, their wages were going to go up, and they would have a better standard of living. Well, when workers actually tried to do that, the government and employers came down on them like a ton of bricks. People got fired, their unions got busted, sometimes people were beaten up and sometimes even killed in that process. So they filed complaints under this side agreement. And to this day, not a single worker has ever been rehired. Not a single independent union has ever gotten a contract because of filing under that complaint. And so now here we hear the same thing being said about Colombia. Colombia is the most dangerous country in the world to be a trade unionist. There are 2,850 trade unionists in Colombia who have been murdered in the last 25 years. And so the Colombian labor movement, their unions are saying, hey, this trade agreement is a bad deal, and the promises that it's going to protect our labor rights are as hollow as the promises under NAFTA that it was going to protect the labor rights of Mexicans.
You know, I remember, and I sat probably 20 feet from candidate Obama when he said, he said this about they're going to have...
You can trust me when I say that whenever trade deals we negotiate come to my desk, they are going to be good for American workers. That they'll have powerful labor and environmental protections, and that we will enforce those protections.
So do these three free trade agreements, do they live up to that promise?
No, they don't. They don't at all. They are going to cost us jobs. You know, there is no way that these trade agreements are going to produce jobs for us here, because the whole purpose of negotiating these agreements is to make it easier for U.S. corporations to, number one, outsource jobs from here to countries where the wages are cheaper. In other words, it's going to be easier for them to move jobs to Colombia or to South Korea. And they are going to contribute to the decline in wages and the labor rights. You know, the Korean labor movement, you know, they, on the one hand, you know, you might expect them to say, well, this is a good agreement for us, because what it's going to mean possibly is that Hyundai and Kia are going to be able to sell more cars in the U.S. because the tariffs are going to go down. Well, that's not what the Korean trade union movement is saying. In fact, what they're saying is that this is a NAFTA-style agreement. It's not going to protect our labor rights. And after all, Korean trade union leaders have been arrested and thrown in prison by the Korean government, much as people have been in Mexico. And they say it's not going to protect our rights. And at the same time, it's going to rob many more jobs in Korea, and it's going to have a terrible effect in the countryside, where farmers are going to suffer the same kind of dumping that happened in Mexico. So whatever little we might get in terms of, you know, more Hyundais being sold in the United States is going to be vastly outweighed by the job loss that we're going to suffer here too. So they don't see that trade agreement as being a protection, and we shouldn't either, because it's not going to protect our jobs either.
It's another race to the bottom. But again, I look at it, you know, what was it, 83 to the 15, 77 to 22. South Korea got 83 votes, you know, in the Senate, and the other two got 77. That's as bipartisan as you're ever going to get at a time when both parties are supposedly polarized in their politics.
Well, they're not polarized on trade, and they're not polarized on basically doing favors for, you know, the large corporations who are going to benefit from this. You know, there is no way that you can be a senator or a Congress member in this country and not be very, very aware by this time that our unions, our working people, are very much opposed to these agreements and are shouting as loud as they can, saying, hey, wait a minute, how can you negotiate these agreements that are going to cost us jobs in the middle of a recession? So who is it that wants these agreements? Who, when these Congress members and these senators vote in favor of these agreements, who is it that they think they're going to please by doing that? Because it's certainly not working people here. And really, the only people they're going to please is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that's, you know, ecstatic over the idea that they're going to have three new trade agreements in their pocket.
And
it's basically the same kind of policy as serving the banks and serving large corporations that we've seen.
Yep.
You know, time and time and time again.
And my big fear is we're gonna give corporate America what they want. They can treat union members here in the U.S. like they do in Colombia. David Bacon, I appreciate the time. The peace, free trade agreements, killing jobs and labor rights, over at truthout.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com, to David's piece. It's always great talking to you. And I got to tell you, you do some fantastic photojournalism. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Rick.
All right. Talk to you again real soon. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, questions, comments, back after this.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
Gather round, children, and I'll tell you another fairy tale. But I must warn you, this one is really, really scary. So hold on to each other. It's about Rick Perry, the swaggering Texas governor who wants very, very much to be the Republican nominee for president. So, to get Republican primary voters to like him, he has been riding all across the country on a big horse he calls money, claiming that he will save people everywhere by shooting down the horror of Romney Care. What's that, you ask? It's the Massachusetts Health Insurance Plan, developed by Ramblin' Rick's presidential rival, Mitt Romney. Why is it dangerous? Because, explains Perry, it is, quote, the model for socialized medicine. Big bad government should not be involved in health care, he shouts at Republican rallies, declaring that the sainted free market is the best provider of insurance. That's how we do it in Texas, he brags, and here comes the scary part. I'll bring the Texas model to all of America. Ooh, boy, that would not be nice or healthy. Under Pericare, more than 6 million Texans, including 1.3 million children, are left with no health coverage at all, the highest rate of uninsured residents in the country. Also, the price that people must pay for insurance has nearly doubled under Perry's reign, and he has slashed state spending and curbed eligibility for programs to help hard-hit families get health services, including cutting 200,000 Texas children out of a program to assure that low-income youngsters get health care. So, children, beware of yee-hawing Texas politicos spreading tales of free market miracles. Texans themselves find nothing miraculous about Pericare, referring to it as the yo-yo plan. You're on your own. This is Jim Hightower saying, luckily, though, people can write their own happy ending to this scary fairy tale. Just don't vote for it.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, you can take a look at the podcast right there. You can get the smartphone Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So a new Reuters Ipsos poll came out. Mitt Romney on top of the pack right now. Perry has fallen back to fourth place. Herman Cain has jumped up to second place with Ron Paul there in the third spot. Romney got 23% of the votes, just up from 20. Herman Cain went from 7 to 19. Ron Paul up to 13%. And, of course, Rick Perry, who was on top not too long ago, down to 10%. And the reality is, you know, whoever it is that runs against Obama, polls not doing so well for the president. He has a 50% disapproval rating, according to Reuters and this Ipsos poll. So you've got folks who are, you know, fairly pessimistic, not happy. The survey also showed that nearly three-quarters of the country thinks we're going down the wrong path. 21% think we're on the right track. I'm of the mindset we were heading in the right direction until the Republicans blew up the road. Until they put a roadblock right dead smack in the middle of the road, and now we got problems. There is one bright spot, evidently, for the Democrats, according to the Reuters Ipsos poll. 48% say they want Democrats in the congressional races in the 2012 election cycle. If it were held today, 48% would vote for Democrats, 40% for Republicans. So that's, I guess, a bright spot for them. But given what they did today, I'm not so sure. These trade agreements, not doing it for me. Very, very unhappy, very, very, very sad day for me. Anyway, I was looking at this story in the Sentinel, and it's one of those things where you go, you know why the country's crumbling? You know why our infrastructure's falling apart? You know why we've got problems? The headline read, Newville considers first tax hike in 17 years. Now, one could argue that the tax rates of that community were so exorbitant, they were so high that, you know, it could absorb that 17-year span of not raising any revenue to help pay for the services that the people need. But I'm told that's not even remotely close to the truth. In fact of the matter is they were left without police protection for times. This money that they want to raise, this $48,000 in additional revenue, they want to hire a third full-time police officer because evidently, and the article goes into the number of calls that the police in Newville handle. Last year they handled just over 1,000. So far this year, they're beyond that. I think last year was 1,002. This year they're already 1,016. And we still got some time to go. November, October, November, December. We still got 2.5 months to go. And like they said in the article, look, man, those folks are stretched to the brink. And I point to the article we talked about yesterday in Camden County, Georgia, where the insurance industry is going, hey, you don't do something about your fire problems, we're going to double, triple, quadruple your rates, and you homeowners, you're going to pay the bill. So I guess at some point it's pay me now or pay me later. It's pay to have safe neighborhoods or pay to huge premiums to insure it. But in Georgia, they got a bright idea. Let's get inmates. Let's get criminals. Let's get people out of jail to sit in our fire halls. So I was thinking about this. Maybe we should call Newville and say, you know what? We don't want you to raise taxes. We're going to be good Republicans. No new taxes. Read my lips. No new taxes. What we'll do, we'll go to prison, and we'll get people out of prison to be cops. What do you think? I mean, since prison labor seems to be the cure-all, let's have prison cops. Yes. Who knows the criminal mind better than a criminal?
Yeah, but there's safeguards. They're just like in Georgia, Rick, they're picking the good criminals. They're picking the ones that, broke the law or, they deserved to be in prison, but, they were kind of the cream of the crop.
They'll pass the interview? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, kind of.
They'll have good behavior?
Yeah.
They'll only commit drug offenses and theft?
Kind of.
Things like that?
You're getting warm.
Yeah. See, there you go. I think we have solved our problems. We don't need any public services. In fact, here in the city of Harrisburg, we should just get rid of all the city workers and replace them with inmates. We got plenty of those. In fact, here in this country, we lock more people up per capita, by sheer numbers, by percentage, you name it. We got more people locked up than anywhere. We're number one at something.
What defies logic down in Georgia, Rick, I can't believe that the unemployment rate's down there are any better than here. And you have a lot of unemployed that probably would love to be a fireman with the accompanying salary.
But here's the thing. The problem is they don't want to pay them. The Georgia plan. Come on, come back with the Georgia plan. We're going to let businesses hire people and not pay them. The Georgia plan. And I love what this county commissioner guy in Georgia said. He said, I'm not here trying to get inmate firefighters. What I'm trying to do is operate our county as economically as I can. So to the mayor of Newville, operate your area as economically as you can. Go get prison labor. Evidently, that's the... And I don't know if the mayor of Newville is a Republican, but it would fit. It would fit the ideology.
I can almost guarantee he is.
I don't know. I'm not going to make that leap.
Yeah.
But,
I know the area, Rick.
Do it in an economic way. Go get yourself a prisoner. And what better, what better way to stop crime than to have someone who has a criminal mind? I mean, we really have fallen deep into the rabbit hole.
You can't make this stuff up.
I mean, we really have. And it's because we've had politicians who have bet the bank on getting elected and reelected and reelected and reelected by saying, I mortgaged our future, but I didn't raise your taxes today. I didn't raise your taxes to pay for that road that you rode on, so you didn't have to pay for that investment, and you didn't have to pay for the upkeep, and you didn't have to pay for all the other things that you got. So vote for me, because I just kicked it down the road. So here we are now after a massive crisis, a self-made crisis, mind you. Graham Leach, Bliley, something the folks in the occupation movement have said we need to get rid of, reinstate Glass-Steagall. A self-made crisis. This crisis has really just harmed this country in a way that is irreparable. I mean, it without raising taxes on people who have it, we're going to continue in this hole. And it's going to get worse. I mean, Harrisburg filing for bankruptcy, I don't think anybody's really surprised at that. I think a year ago most people were saying it's probably going to happen. But But how many other cities are going to fall? How many other communities are going to do this? And how many other communities are going to start looking for alternatives to police and fire and ambulance and 911 operators? How many people are going to start looking for alternatives to be, you know, to operate their area as economically as they can? You know, maybe the collapse is what we need at some point. You know, maybe the quote-unquote harder down is what we need. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, right back after this.
Me and my people are through. Me and my people are ready. Me and my people are just about due. Better start counting. We're coming out. We're coming out swinging.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen.
Love to have anything you could produce for us.
Oh yeah, I just threw it to you and said, hey, you know.
I know, I was so wiped out. Like last week was the week from hell because I was so tired from Sudan, and then I had that congressional testimony of Kier, so it was crazy.
So how was the trip there?
Sudan, it was amazing as always. I mean, it's always just mind-blowing that, you know, people are able to survive and that people live like this, and it's really amazing.
It is amazing. All right, well, let's get you through this so we can get this late.
Right. Oh, right. You got my list, right?
Yes, I do.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm still flipped off. The vote, just absolutely amazing on these free trade agreements. I just, yeah, when will it end? Well, when will this insanity end? I just don't know. Frustrating. Anyway, here to talk to us about what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, frustration is the word of the day. You should have heard some of this debate. Here you have the Economic Policy Institute, who basically said no jobs are going to be created out of this. You have a situation where I think it was Marcy Kaptur, I'm not sure who, pointed out that less than 5% of cars in Korea are actually foreign-made. So what, we're going to export, we're going to import 750,000 cars, and maybe we'll export 75,000 cars.
Yep.
That's basically what they were saying on the floor of the House.
And the scary part of that provision is only 35% domestic content rule, which means that we could be buying parts from the North Koreans. And they could be buying cars from us made in Mexico. It's insanity to me.
Well, and the excuses, I think the stretch of the day goes to Kay Bailey Hutchison, who made her, you know, agreements on agriculture and all that. But she said basically Colombia had done so much in terms of changing the drug trade that they deserve to have this.
Yeah, and it wasn't just her. It was also Max Backdoris, another one of these, you know, these Democrats who you go, really? You're going to take that position? Oh, they've been so good, and they're trying. And look, they only killed 23 union leaders this year, 51 last year, only 23. So there's improvement there.
Like the cartels aren't still running the drug trade? It's Amazing.
It's nuts to me. And beyond this, again, we're not going to create jobs around this. And, you know, I understand why those, why the people are out in the streets in New York and in Philadelphia and St. Louis and, you know, all across this country, because both parties sold the working people of this country out today.
It was really pretty amazing, and the White House, of course, was supporting it as well.
Yep.
So we'll see.
I mean, you look at the South Korean agreement, 83 senators voted for it. 83. I mean, that bipartisanship. You look at the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, 262, and the House voted for it. Just mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing.
So they got it done just in time. I guess the Korean president going to be here tomorrow, state visit, going to have the whole congressional thing.
Well, actually, yes. In fact, I was in front of the White House, and he was just getting out of a car. He and the president actually went to a Korean restaurant that was started after World War II in Virginia, very upscale restaurant.
Not very good. I mean, he's going to be a happy guy. I mean, he's going to be able to say, go home and say, I'm bringing home the bacon. We're opening up those doors.
He is.
Let me ask you a question. I was watching Ron Wyden yesterday talking about the trade agreements. I was watching him on C-SPAN, and he said that beef from Oregon going to South Korea has a 40% tariff on it. But beef coming from South Korea to the United States has a 4% tariff on it. Am I the only one who's questioning why we're trading beef with South Korea? Why are we sending it to them, and why are they, the other question being, why are they sending it to us? Don't we produce enough for all of us?
Well, we do, but, you know, there are these special, it's Japanese, but also they have all these special raised beef in there, and I guess there's a taste for it. I don't know. I stopped eating beef 4 years ago.
There you go. Anyway, the other big news yesterday, the plot to kill the Saudi ambassador. What's going on around that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually know Adel Al-Jabbar pretty well. He used to be, before he became ambassador, was sort of the spokesperson. I used to appear on Fox with him quite a bit. And it's interesting. They said it was his favorite restaurant that they were planning on doing it. They won't name the restaurant, but most of us in Washington know where Adel Al-Jabbar likes to go eat. But what's interesting is the president knew about this plot, and I guess they'd been following these characters since June. Now, if that's the case, you wonder where one of them is, that they can't find one of these guys.
Yeah. And you wonder why now.
Right.
I mean, again, you know, I'm not a big conspiracy nut, but I do ask the question of why now, and why tell us? Why not just deal with it?
Well, that's right. And if this was what nobody asked at the White House today is, well, what happened between June and October?
That too. I mean, and why not just deal with this? And again, it's all reasons for the anti-government people, in my opinion, to go, see, look, they can't do it. We don't need them. It's nuts. More craziness. Supreme Court today, some interesting news?
Yes, there was a very interesting case before the Supreme Court. A man was picked up, and they said there was a warrant out for him that he hadn't paid a warrant. Well, he had the paper in his hand that he paid the warrant. It was a simple traffic violation. In any case, I guess they didn't believe him on the warrant. They put him in jail, and they strip searched him.
Really?
And the issue is just because you're picking up somebody on a traffic violation, do you have a right to strip search them? And that was really the issue that came before the Supreme Court. Not sure where they're going to be when it finished. The people who believe they do have a right to strip search him was the town where he was taken to jail. They are defending the case.
Well, I would assume from the police's perspective they want to know if he's got a weapon or not before they lock him up. From a, you know, a personal liberty position, I don't know that I want to be strip searched.
Well, that's exactly what, I mean, you got, as you often do, you got the argument in a nutshell.
So the jobs bill shot down. Some Democrats, you know, turned their back on the president. This you knew this jobs bill wasn't going to go anywhere, but tell me what's going on.
Well, essentially, this came up again at the White House today as to what the president is willing to do, and he is willing to sign pieces of it. But then the question is, if it's done in pieces, as the White House said, the president's going to say, okay, where's the rest? And that he's willing to sign the legislation in pieces, but he wants really the pretty much the whole of it passed.
Well, I mean, I think you've got to – what bothers me is you're going to see – and the Democrats are good at caving – so you'll see all of the things that Republicans have wanted with none of the things they're going to help get the economy going again. The infrastructure spending, maybe bits and pieces, but the trade agreements, they're already through. That's what they've wanted for the longest time, and as we've seen a large number of Democrats do. But here again, I'm not thrilled with this. Not happy.
Do not blame you.
Not happy. Lastly, Daryl Issa's mug was all over the news today. A fishing expedition or not?
Well, I mean, the sheer number of papers that he has subpoenaed, I mean, the Justice Department will be doing nothing but that for, you know, several weeks. I think that they're asking for every meeting he's had. I mean, give me a break.
If I'm Holder, you know what I do? I send him absolutely everything that I have in 53-foot trailers. Here you go. Good luck. Spend some time on it.
Right. Well, the problem is, as one of the Democrats said, the problem is that there are names in their investigations in there that have never been asked for by Congress, that are ongoing investigations, et cetera, that are considered, you know, national security, et cetera.
Well, to me, it's just they're just trying to, you know, do what Republicans have been doing very well for the last couple of years. Obstruct, delay, gridlock, tie things up and play the clock. They're just working the clock out, because I do believe they think 2012 is their year, because I think Democrats are going to lose the Senate. And I think a lot of other people think that as well. It's a matter of they can take the House back and keep the White House.
Well, it was interesting. I talked to a Democrat, and I'm very friendly with Senator Stabenow from Michigan, and a friend of mine is a Democrat. Said, "Well, Ellen, she's going to lose." I said, "No."
You don't think so? You don't think the Democrats are going to lose to the Senate?
I don't actually.
But they're defending 23 seats.
I know.
Against the 10 for Republicans, and I'm looking at Hawaii, that governor. Who was very popular at one point, is throwing her hat into the ring. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, we'll see what happens next year, but I'm not hopeful.
Well, I'm always hopeful.
And that's what we love about you, Ellen. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what's going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight, Jay?
Thanks, Rick. When we thought the Harrisburg City bankruptcy was going to settle down a little bit, it seems to have exploded. Yesterday, it was made known that the city council had filed for bankruptcy, and the reaction was immediate. Bloomberg came out with a report that said that Harrisburg was, in fact, the ninth city in the country to declare bankruptcy. Other sources have intimated that Harrisburg right now is the most high-profile city that has tried to declare bankruptcy. But the reaction of the power structure was, I think, a real telling tale. It was immediate, and it was total opposition. City Council decision to file for bankruptcy won't stand, that according to a spokesman from the governor. Senator Pakola, who has been intricately involved in this situation from the start, issued this statement. "I have been on the record as saying the bankruptcy is simply not an option. It's illegal under Pennsylvania law, which prohibits third-class cities from filing for bankruptcy." Spokesman for the mayor of Harrisburg said this: "Harrisburg Council's vote to hire a lawyer to fight a state takeover in behalf of the city and its second vote to seek bankruptcy protections are illegal per city law," according to Robert Fillman, who's a spokesperson for the mayor. Dauphin County commissioners, as one, had issued a statement, said this: "We are currently reviewing the petition for municipal bankruptcy filed this morning by Harrisburg City Council. Based on our initial review, the filing by City Council is not properly authorized under the law." They went on to say basically that it's nothing more than a delay tactic to avoid making the tough decisions. But the organization that came out with this, which I found the most intriguing and probably the most insightful, was from an organization by the name of Death Watch. Debt Watch. D-E-P-T. It's easy for me to say. Debt Watch. By its own definition, it's an organization of citizens that want to make sure that the the citizens, the taxpayers, are treated well in this whole process. This is what they said. The filing was a culmination of a series of failures of leadership at the local, county, and state levels. Intransigent has dominated the ugly course of events to date, with many officials at every level being irrevocably locked into arbitrary positions issue after issue. And that statement encapsulates this whole sorry history of Harrisburg. And as our friend Irwin Aronson has so aptly articulated, the real victims, the very real victims, are the public servants of the city, the police and firemen and the city employees who keep the city safe, who respond to fires and perform the services that keep the city running efficiently. These dedicated servants, sadly, are the real victim. It's a sad, sad situation with possibly even more to come. We've talked off and on for the last couple of months about privatization of the wine and spirit stores. Subject came up about beer. Now, what you would say, well, what does beer have to do? Well, it seems that there's a couple large grocery stores in the state, like Sheetz and Giant, who are complaining that under the present law, because of the fact that in many of the Sheetz and the Giant, they have gas stations attached to these outlets, by law they cannot sell beer. They're applying pressure to the legislature, and according to a spokesman for the Republican, Steve Mitchkin, they probably will change the wording in House Bill 11 to try to allow these stores to sell beer. Now, the real issue that I think could be key is the fact that beer distributorships throughout the state, the organization has opposed. Why? Very simply. If you privatize wine and spirits, you hurt, the way it's constituted, you hurt the beer distributorships. They are opposed to the present law. They are applying pressure with some effectiveness. You couple that with the fact that in some of the conservative districts that are represented by Republicans, for the most part, the public has come out and said, we oppose the privatization of wine and spirits because its negative effect on society and on our environment within the communities. You take these two issues, and right now there are some votes that those who want to privatize the wine and spirits will not get. Now, will they be key? We'll have to wait and see, but they, in the end, this could very well be key. One other story. Job Council has called for an infrastructure action. The President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness issued a 52-page, which calls for 5 common-sense initiatives to boost jobs and competitiveness. Some of the recommendations include spurring entrepreneurship, boosting jobs, creating investment by global corporations headquartered in the United States and U.S.-based multinationals. Amen to that. On this show, we've been calling for that literally for the last couple years. Simplifying regulatory reviews and streamlining project approvals, ensuring U.S. workers have the education, training, and skills to fill current and newly created job openings, and that's a must. The truth is, there's a lot of countries who are our chief competitors who have a better training apparatus to educate their workers than we do. Back to you, Rick.
All righty. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. Stick around. We're right back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can get the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app, and you can take the program with you. If you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com. The best way to get a hold of me, and you know, during the break, I got an email from Andy who said, I'm just decimated. Just decimated over these three free trade deals. There doesn't seem to be any hope. But revolution, no other solutions. And he's looking at the numbers. EPI points out 159,000 job losses from South Korea alone. We had steelworker President Leo Girard on this program talking about, you know, it's going to cost us, you know, some 159,000 jobs for the total. We know we're going to lose jobs on this. And, you know, Andy points out that the massive trade deficits that we've got with Mexico, you talk about the massive trade deficits that we've had with China, this trade thing, well, look, we are exporting a lot of things, yes, but we are on the losing end of the trade deal. And you can only sustain that for so long. Really, I mean, the last time this nation had an overall trade surplus, now think about this, the last time as a nation we had a trade surplus with the rest of the world, meaning that we as a whole exported more than we brought in, was 1975. You look around, there are a lot of people who weren't even born yet in 1975. And that's the last time we had a surplus. And we've been following this neoliberal trade policy, this tearing down borders, this race to the bottom. Hey, let's move good-paying union jobs to areas that are exploitable because, hey, you know, we don't want to give those countries foreign aid to help them build themselves. No, no, we need to give them jobs. And I think George Carlin used to do a great bit, and I miss that guy. But, you know, he said, you know, he was talking about Vietnam, and he's like, you know, the whole thing, you know, we get into these wars, and we whip a little industry on them, you know, because we need to build them up, you know, World War II, you know, you go back and you look at all these conflicts, you know, whip a little industry on them. Because after all, that is our job. Go in, blow a bunch of stuff up, and build up some industry. Because after all, as Carlin pointed out, the two middle letters in the word industry, U.S., And he's absolutely right. I mean, so we took jobs that used to support American workers with good pay, good, decent benefits, and we said, yeah, let that stuff go overseas. That's just dirty factory work. We're much better than that. We are going to educate our people, and we're going to push papers, and we're going to have a service-based economy. So you can start a business, you know, cooking dinner for somebody, and they can start a business cutting grass, and that guy over there can start a business washing windows, and that guy over there can wash dogs, and that woman over there can clean, and we'll just have this wonderful economy of people serving each other. But we won't add value to things. We'll leave that dirty industry over there. Does it make a lot of sense to you? And I look today at these trade agreements. We are going to lose more manufacturing. Do you see any? Do you see jobs from Colombia coming here? We don't have the climate to grow much cocaine. We don't have the ability to make the coffee. We need coffee and cocaine. That's the stimulant country. And why Panama? Well, we already import into that country. We actually have a trade surplus with them. So we have a free trade agreement that's going to screw that up. And do you know why we're having a free trade agreement with them? Two reasons. One, another nice safe haven for our billionaires to park their money. And two, they're doing a whole bunch of building around the Panama Canal. And U.S. engineering firms and U.S. big corporations want to go in there and they want to underbid those contracts so that they can bring slave labor in from somewhere else to actually do the work. Profit, my friends. And, of course, South Korea. How else are you going to get Chinese goods into the U.S. Without the conduit of South Korea? How else is that going to happen? And I share Andy's anger. I share his frustration. And we've gone through the numbers. Year after year after year, we've had trade deficits with all of these countries. And look, you just cannot survive. And people are in the streets. And you know what? Maybe the Tea Party people and the folks who are occupying Wall Street and occupying Philadelphia and occupying all of these places, maybe they come together and maybe, and I would love to see the T-Twits get out and participate in the general assemblies. Leave the guns at home. You know, leave the tri-fold hats, leave those at home. Come out and participate in an actual Athenian democracy. Just a thought. And maybe talk about trade. Seems like a good idea to me. But, you know, again, comes down to you got to get involved. You got to be active. You got to be engaged. So another right wing, this time the group is called Americans for Securing the Border. Got to love that. And it's not enough that they want to build a fence. No. Don't just want one fence. No, they want a double fence. They want two. So I'm sure there's Americans for Border Security out there who's calling for a fence. But Americans for Securing the Border, they want two. And I'm sure there's somebody out there going, gee, I can do better than that. Americans for Borders That Are Secure, we want three and guard dogs.
And I was going to say, I wonder what do they want to do with the East Germans did? Have two fences and then, you know, have mines in between? Is that what they want?
Yeah. Let's do that. Let's start a pledge with that. Nice. And we can put it all on TV. It'd be a great reality show. Watch those Mexicans run through the minefield. I mean, have you seen reality TV lately? I'm sure I'm not the first one to have thought of this. But no, they've got another pledge. They want the candidates to pledge to support and speedily expedite the construction of a date-certain, secure double fence. What are we going to do? See you tomorrow. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO.